So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review me.
I'm sure Mick Foley lives in constant daily pain, but he has his wife, and he has his children, and his family loves him. And there's a lot of people in this business that can't say that.
He's made millions. He has saved millions. But he still has that amazing work ethic where he works like he's broke.
I'm able to make my own schedule. I see my kids doing a pretty good job as a dad, I think. And I hope I caught these injuries in time. You know, give up the roller coasters. Look off camera when someone flashes a light bulb. Every once in a while, when I have to walk down more than a couple flights of stairs, I'll say, what have I done to myself? But I'm in pain, and these things apparently don't get better. But this is stuff that I knew as I was launching myself, offering imprints onto concrete. So you don't often hear me complain. I'm doing pretty good. Pretty good.
Welcome to Review Away. It is John Pollock and Wei Ting with you. Another edition of Review Away. How's it going, Wei?
Excellent. Oh, it's going fantastic.
That's great. You ready to chat about Mick Foley today?
Yes, I am. I got my water with me.
Oh, water. I'm on my second coffee here. This one from Starbucks.
Second. Okay.
Yep.
Man, I really notice the effects of coffee because I took a coffee right before I was on the Kings of Sport podcast with Nate Milton.
You needed a performance enhancer.
Well, I wasn't even intending on that. I just happened to have time to kill, and so I went to a McDonald's where they're having dollar drink days.
Oh.
And I got myself a $1 iced coffee, and I was just wired for the whole day.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
So I totally understand why people drink coffee, and I understand why people are as effective as they are.
How did that go?
It was a lot of fun. I believe you can probably check it out right now. Cheap plug.
Yeah.
Kings of Sport on iTunes.
Wait, what did you guys chat about?
Everything.
Everything.
Actually, primarily we chatted about this podcast and my how I got into wrestling, like as a fan, and what brought me onto the law. Talked a lot about, you know, meeting you. And just my life story, my autobiography.
I'm very intrigued. Will I learn something?
Yeah, I'm sure you will.
Wow, I'm excited.
You'll learn some stuff about hip-hop as well. We venture into that.
That's cool. So I think the next guest I have to have on is Gordon.
Why is that?
Just because.
Okay.
I want to make Gordon a star. That's my goal.
Yeah.
I want him to do his own show for us.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't really watch wrestling, but, like, well, I don't want to talk to him about that.
Yeah. I would like for you to, like, just, if we went out some night and hung out with him and we just have a recorder going.
Oh, yeah.
And then we put, like, the best of Gordon, and that would be his weekly show.
That's the show.
He doesn't even know he has a show that's, like, going to be number one on iTunes.
That's a great idea. We'll do it.
Yeah.
Next time we'll just, like, hang out. I'll leave my phone right here. Like, you know, like,
yeah.
Pretend it's recording, even though, or pretend it's not recording.
Yeah.
That'd be great. We'll just like, and we'll host the show. Like,
yeah, you know. We can like just be talking to him, and then Gordon he'll immediately get his curiosity will be going, and he'll be all paranoid like he usually is whenever we start talking.
We should actually do this.
Do you want to?
Yeah, I do.
And is this like, legal?
I mean, he's
we're not, doing it for his own good.
Yeah, he's not.
No one's gonna be hurt.
He's
by
not gonna
it.
Sue us.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
What the fuck, man?
I know enough dirt about him so that even if he sues, like we'll be fine. And like we should leave like a feedback thread and all of a sudden try to work in a feedback.
Yeah, this could be like our Truman Show.
Yeah,
this guy could be like our social experiment,
real life Truman Show. Yeah, as far as I know, he doesn't even like listen to podcasts. So I don't think he doesn't like he's
he
not
would
on the
never
internet.
Know this existed.
No, he would never know.
We kid. This is actually a great idea.
I actually think we should do this. Yeah, it'd be funny.
Got to come up with like the best name ever for it. Like,
Chi Show.
Because his name is...
I know. Chinese exactly.
Name.
Exactly.
Chinese name is Chi Show.
Chi Show.
Like Q-I-X-I-U, like some the way Chinese people spell it. But it'll be like the Chi Show.
Do you know that we're doing two reviews today?
I didn't know that.
Yep.
Oh, I'm only prepared for one.
No, so. You're prepared for two, because we promised on Monday night at the end of Review of Raw that we were going to have a bonus review, because both of us have now seen Iron Man 3.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I saw this movie on Saturday night.
Yeah.
And, I mean, going into this movie way, I mean, the unofficial slogan for this movie is, it's not as good as the first one, but it's better than the second. I haven't heard one person that's seen this movie that has not followed up their assessment by stating that.
Right.
So I went into this with lowered expectations than I think most, because I had waited like a week to see this.
The first one was just so good, you know?
Yeah, like, and Robert Downey Jr. is like... Yeah. I mean, that was such a huge comeback for the guy. It's like he stole the first movie, and it was a good movie.
Not only that, like, that was a comeback for Iron Man, because, like, for years before that, I mean, Iron Man, even within the comic books, was just kind of like a jokish character. Like, I mean, it wasn't a joke, but, like, people, he certainly didn't have the stock that he does now. Like, now, because of Robert Downey Jr.'s performance, because of that, like, great script, the everything to do with that first movie, it's really, like, upped Iron Man's stock within all facets. You know, he's got, a TV show. He's, like, being billed as a leader of the Avengers, which was never really the case before.
Yeah. So how does that first movie do so great, it's received so well, the fuck happens to number two? Like, you had Jon Favreau behind both movies. Yeah. Like, why was the second such a fuck-up?
It's not that... personally, I didn't think number two was that bad.
I can't remember the second one. I saw it. I can't remember a goddamn thing.
It was Mickey Rourke. He's like this Russian guy who... I don't know, who's jealous of...
I'm tempted to go rewatch it to remind myself. Because I watched this movie, and literally, I think I left the movie theater and I dumped it out of my brain, because I have no recollection of this movie.
It was simply, like, not as good as the first one. Because I think the first one just had a lot of unexpected elements to it, like, you know, the whole thing with the terrorism and you know, just the shock of kind of seeing this awesome Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, I think was a big thing to do with that. But number two was just kind of your more typical, you know, average superhero movie.
Yeah. What would have been your favorite superhero movies of, like, the last 10 years, the ones that you...
Well, of course, like, The Dark Knight was great. Mm-hmm. With that might have been my favorite, actually. And then Iron Man was great.
Did you like The Avengers last year?
I liked The Avengers,
yeah. I did, too.
Personally, though, you know, the hype was a bit overblown for me by the time that I actually got to watch it. So, I don't know. That might have kind of diminished my interest. But X-Men First Class was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, that was real. I've liked pretty much all of the X-Men movies, dating back to the first one.
Well, except the third one, right?
The third one, I can't remember, so... I
like
the first two. I don't even know if I saw the third one, to be honest. I think I saw the first two, and then I saw the First Class.
I recommend that you don't. And I don't know, have you seen Wolverine Origins?
No, I didn't see that.
You probably shouldn't see that either.
I didn't like Captain America that much. Didn't do it for me.
Yeah.
I didn't like Thor either.
Well, performance, box office performance-wise, Iron Man is there high? I mean, Avengers first, but then Iron Man.
I think Iron Man 3 is going to beat Avengers. They're almost at a billion already.
No way, really?
It's at like $970 million worldwide already.
Wow.
In like just over a week.
You know, they're very smart with that. I imagine like a big portion of that might be from China, because they made a Chinese version of the film using like two Chinese, or at least a number of Chinese actors. And so that's the version that I want to see next, is the Chinese version of Iron Man 3.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Is it the exact same movie, like the same script?
It is, but there are just extra scenes with China, like a whole subplot, I assume, with Chinese people.
But getting back to the third movie, did you like the movie, first of all?
I liked it.
Think about it. I had some issues with it. I mean, a little bit. The scene where the Mandarin and the other dude.
Oh, hold on. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. There's going to be lots of spoilers. We're talking about Iron Man. If you haven't seen it by now, come on. It's like they've almost made $1 billion. How has your $12.75 not been spent on it yet?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. The scene where they attack, I'll try not to be too spoiler heavy, when they attack Tony Stark's home.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, I'm watching the fucking, like, medieval Earth here coming, crashing down, and, like, what's her name? Potts is just like standing there. It's like, how is this woman just standing here?
Where's she supposed to go?
Well, I'm just saying, how does she avoid death here? And then again, at the end of the movie, she falls into like this giant fire and then regenerates.
No, because by that point, by then she was implanted with the Extremis stuff.
And so
she became a cyborg.
I hate death teases. They're boring to me.
It was, I felt like maybe in this movie you had to suspend your disbelief a bit more than some of the others. And
a lot of people are shitting on the Mandarin.
Yeah, the way they treated the Mandarin, especially, our colleague right here, George Barbosa, who is a diehard comic book fan.
Oh, yes.
He had real issues with the way they took this character, the Mandarin, and basically turned
him into... I'm a big fan of Mandarin as well.
Oh, the restaurant.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you are. I know. You know what? The Mandarin is not so bad. I went recently.
Oh, you've come around on it.
Yeah. I mean, as a Chinese person, I don't know.
You think that they're making fun of you or something?
No, it's just like, man, as a Chinese person, the last place I would ever consider going for Chinese food is Mandarin. But I went. It's like, it's not so bad.
It's really good.
You just don't have to think about it as Chinese food. You got to think about it as
all-you-can-eat buffet.
A buffet.
Which is excellent.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Anyway, I liked the like terrorist videos they put together for the Mandarin. Those are great.
Yeah, those are good. But again, you really have to suspend your disbelief because there's no way a terrorist like Osama bin Laden
could take over every single network worldwide.
Okay,
the same
that
thing.
I could believe.
Oh,
because that's comic books. But like, I don't know. Like, I felt like the first movie was really well grounded in reality, and a lot of this probably has to come down to the switch of direction, like the director
Shane Black
instead
of
Jon Favreau. But because like, there's no way Osama bin Laden would have a perfectly lit TV set with multiple camera cuts and like artistic looking camera shots. And maybe I'm biased or I'm watching from like an ultra critical eye. Because, like, this is, like, what I do, but...
How do you know that wasn't the setup for Osama's videos that he sent out?
What do you mean?
Like, he used to send out videos.
Yeah, I know. And like, they all looked like they were shot in a fucking cave with the handy cam.
Maybe they were designed to be like that. Maybe they were in a sound studio in a cave somewhere.
Fine. But at least it looked that way, Like, this, it just looked too perfect, too well done. I mean, one of the other issues, I guess, is why didn't he call the Avengers?
Well, because they weren't under contract for the movie.
No, realistic.
One of the Avengers makes it into this movie. If you stuck around for the end credits at the end,
yeah.
What a letdown that scene was.
Yeah, that was...
Don't stick around after the credits. No. I hated that. I thought that was like, haha, you stuck around for this. And the joke was, what a boring movie this was. I fell asleep right away.
Yeah.
I hated it. I didn't take it as any kind of tease.
No, clearly they had nothing to tease or nothing they I don't know. I don't know if people were tied up with contracts, but like at least something, teasing the next Thor movie or the next Captain America movie would be cool.
I think a large part is they don't know what is going to be next. They don't have Robert Downey Jr. signed for anything more.
Oh, he'll be back.
This fucking guy made $75 million for this movie.
Yeah.
And $50 million for the Avengers.
Well, he made more for this than the Avengers?
Yeah, apparently.
Wow.
If what I read is correct.
Yeah, well,
$75 million for this fucking movie.
But how much did Disney and Marvel make from it?
Oh, tons!
Right,
I'm sure it's worth their investment.
And if you're Robert Downey Jr., obviously you're gonna try.
Do you want to see a fourth Iron Man? Like, put aside the money they can make on this thing.
I don't know.
That's a given. But they kind of wrapped it up for me. I don't know if I necessarily want to. I want to see another Avengers movie, but I'm not dying to see a fourth Iron Man at this point. I don't want to see Potts involved becoming like the. His sidekick, and I know that's where the book goes, but like they kind of wrapped it up for me.
Yeah. I personally, unless they can get a good story or, have a completely new spin on things, I'm not too interested at the moment. I wasn't honestly really interested in the third one.
Yeah. Are you going to go see The Man of Steel? It's out next month?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not in a big rush to see it, but yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. Are you?
I'll probably go see it. I'm curious.
What else are you watching these days, movie-wise?
Oh, that's it. I just went to go see that. I was going to go see Pain and Gain, but so many people have told me it's horrible that I'm not going to go see it anymore.
Okay.
So that's it. How about you? Any movies that you want to check out?
Mm.
I heard Evil Dead's really good. My buddy saw it and said it's the best movie he's seen this year.
Yeah. No, no. I can't say there's anything I'm too interested in.
I just watched the Mick Foley documentary.
So did I.
Oh, wow. Let's talk about it.
All right.
This was their latest release from E1 Entertainment. Lengthy documentary here.
What is E1 Entertainment?
The distributor.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Is that...
They're the... Yeah, the DVD distributor for right. The WWE.
I see, okay.
Yep.
Is that, are those the guys that give the prize packs?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So we love them.
You don't have to love them.
No, I'm just curious. I always hear their names, but I don't know exactly what they're involved in.
They're the ones who put the physical DVDs together.
They put the DVDs into the stores.
Yes.
They ship them into the stores.
That's what they do.
Cool. And they put the packages together? Like somebody closes the cases and then puts the plastic wrap on the case?
I don't know where that is exactly done, but I would assume yes. They
have some hand.
They're on the hook for making this look pretty and sending it out.
It's good to know.
Yeah.
Good job.
What did you think of this documentary in two words or less?
Two words or less. Seen it.
Me too.
Yeah.
Well, 2.5 hours away, this documentary went.
Let me elaborate. What I mean by that is...
Well, I was hoping you would elaborate.
Okay, well, what I mean...
A shitty podcast.
What I mean by that is just... I think most of us kind of know the story of Mick Foley. And perhaps those of us that do will find a lot of this documentary kind of redundant in terms of information.
Put out quite a few now on a number of guys. I mean, we've had multiple releases for Austin, for Rock. We're getting another Triple H DVD later this year. It feels like it's very much of what a lot of comic book based movies have been, where it's like after so many years.
Reboot.
Yeah. It's like we can do this all over again and people are just going to buy this again. We'll put some new matches on it. We'll do a documentary this time, which we didn't do last time.
Oh,
and
they didn't.
You can keep doing. I don't think they've ever done a Mick Foley, like the full out documentary like this.
It would have been nice for them to actually reboot his origin. Like he didn't do any of that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Where he was like, he came from like a upper middle class.
But I mean,
his father was a promoter.
What I mean is, having read his books. As somebody who has done that, I feel like, and not even just that, but like if you were watching the Mick Foley TV from like, 97, 98, they dive a lot into his origins, the videotapes that we've all seen from the backyard and everything. So a lot of this stuff, this documentary I thought did a great job of putting everything together, but I mean, if you've read his book, if you've seen a lot of that other stuff, it might be a little redundant for you.
Sure. I mean, you're right. He's put out 4 autobiographies at this point. There have been past DVD releases, and I would think that over the years, a lot of these stories you've somewhat heard. What I really liked about this, and this was something that they applied to the CM Punk DVD, I'm sure this is going to be for the Steve Austin one they did, Triple H's one coming up, is that it's more than just the usual WWE talking heads. Like,
yes.
They seem to really go out of their way now to find key people to add to these. You had Vader on this, Kevin Sullivan. Even hearing from guys like Paul Heyman, people that you want to hear from. I would say the only one that really stuck out to me was The Miz, who it's just, he has just this grating, lasting effect on me, where it just feels like this guy is a fucking living, breathing corporate press release.
Right. I know what you mean. I know exactly what
like
you mean.
Like, he's there to state what Michael Cole does every single Monday on Raw, where it's like there's nothing wrong with it, but it doesn't feel genuine with this guy.
I don't doubt that it is, though, because the Miz's role in this movie was to basically portray the fan who has now grown up and was influenced by Mick Foley enough to the point where he was able to reach his goals as an adult.
It's just I don't buy for 2 seconds though that The Miz was watching Mick Foley Vader matches as a child. I don't
think so. Why not?
I don't believe this guy is.
You don't think The Miz was at a party with his a wrestling party with his friends during Hell in a Cell?
100% no.
Why?
I just don't. I don't know. Yeah, it comes across to me. You just as I've said, he doesn't sound genuine to me. I don't believe anything he says.
I don't have any reason to doubt that he wasn't doing that.
Well, maybe he was. I just don't think he added anything to this, though, for me. I would much rather have heard from CM Punk, who I legitimately believed does consider Shawn Michaels and Mankind one of his favorite matches.
Yeah, right.
So that was one of the positives, was the people from outside. But also having, I guess, the length to kind of go into all the different chapters of his career. But you're right. You know, especially the early parts of, you know, how he got into training under Dominic DiNucci. And, of course, the hitchhiking to Madison Square Garden. It's stuff we've heard before. Mm-hmm. It's stuff that I don't think anyone that's even followed Mick Foley's career slightly is aware of all these things.
Right. But it's stuff you absolutely have to talk about, you know, when you're decided to do a Mick Foley documentary. And you know what? Like, we're talking from as two wrestling fans for over 20 years. There are a lot of wrestling fans who have never seen Mick Foley wrestle, period. And, you know, they would probably benefit from seeing all this stuff.
There was some very cool footage they had, not just the mid-80s jobs that he was doing where Kid like roughed him up, like that was great, but footage I've never seen before was from Munich, Germany, where he loses his ear. Camcorder footage.
Yeah, I feel like that might have popped up somewhere, but yeah, you're absolutely right.
I had never seen it before this.
I will say, yeah, they did a fantastic job of analyzing a number of incidents that were only kind of talked about before in his books and whatnot, and one of those was definitely the ear, losing his ear incident, and you get Vader to kind of run through commentary. At one point, they kind of highlight the little point where Vader actually rips off Foley's ear, which he has no recollection of.
After all these years, I'd always thought it just fell off, but I've just seen footage that shows that I did it.
Yeah.
Vader really, it kind of accentuates the reputation this guy has as a, you know, just a guy that worked extremely stiff with guys who did not always enjoy working with Vader. And then they cut to Mick Foley where he's like, one night I purposely didn't wear my gloves and I shut his eye during a match. And they go to Mick Foley and they show his eye all bloody and stuff like that. That these guys had just these ridiculously intense matches that left more so Foley than Vader in bad shape afterwards.
But it was really cool to see a Vader out of character talking, which I'd never really seen before.
Yeah, even without the mask.
Yeah, yeah. So here's this guy playing this monster, and all of a sudden you cut back to present day where he's just a nice real estate agent. Is that what he does?
Yeah. When we had him on the show last year, after Mouth interviewed him, Vader tells him, I want to speak to John Pollock right now after the interview. And I come on. He's like, now when this gets posted online, I want you to send me the link directly. I've done interviews in the past and they have not posted the link. I expect this from you. And you are to contact me when this show is posted. I was like, well, no problem. We're going to air this whole thing and the whole link is going to be up online for people to listen to and I will send it to you.
Yeah.
And he said, great. And I am now, I guess, on some email list with him. So
what happens what does he think happens? These people record interviews with him and just, like, for their own personal...
Maybe some people just want to talk to him on the phone for an hour and they don't record it or... I don't know. That sounds like a waste of time.
It would piss me off if somebody's recording... Like, if you're recording me right now just for your personal collection.
Or if I wasn't even recording this. I did this whole thing just for fun. I'd be pissed, too.
That would be fucked.
Time is valuable. So they also had Shane Douglas interviewed on this, who was part of the training class with Dominic DiNucci.
We had like 3 weeks of Shane Douglas.
Yeah, that's right. It's been Shane Douglas overload.
Yeah,
I don't think there's a DVD coming his way, courtesy of WWE. The Dean years.
The Shane Douglas DVD. The Dean Douglas DVD.
Oh.
The Dean Douglas collection.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
But another one where it was like someone that, you know, not really highly regarded in WWE past. I mean, he's, you know, someone they've never really brought back, paid much attention to. But you really do feel that guys like Mick Foley, the subjects of these DVDs, they do get some say in this, of picking this. Because I can't imagine the WWE was like, well, we need Shane Douglas. We need Vader. I'm sure Mick Foley had a big hand in stating, you know, these are the people I would really like
perhaps
as part of my DVD.
Yeah.
And it's to the WWE's benefit. I mean, we are essentially the audience. I mean, these DVDs, to me, you should be marketing these to your more hardcore fans rather than, you know, casual fans that I don't know if they're really going to go out of their way to buy a $25 DVD.
And it's not like they say anything that's detrimental to the company. Anymore.
No, they're praising the subject, like, in most cases.
What's the harm in getting a Shane Douglas on a DVD? I mean, you know, he's really there's no reason to be threatened at all by guys like that.
We even got. Much like in Punk's DVD, in this one, openly talking about Samoa Joe, which happens later on in the release, where both Punk and Foley talk about Foley recommending both Punk and Joe to the WWE office. And it just feels like there's more of an openness when, you know, you don't have this kind of fear of talking about guys in rival companies.
Yeah. And perhaps a lot of that is because of the success of the CM Punk documentary, where they, you know, they see that this is the way to go. I was really impressed with the amount of footage that was gathered here, in particular some of that early training footage featuring a very young Shane Douglas with Mick Foley at a Dominic DiNucci school. That was really cool. And like you mentioned, some of the jobber footage that he had in the WWE, wrestling guys like Hercules and...
the British Bulldogs was the big match where...
He had a match with Kamala, too. You know, as Jack Foley. So none of the stuff that I didn't even know really existed.
And they really do put a big focus on how he tried to get noticed when he was in WCW, when he was in World Class, working in Memphis, one of the stars we have, Ultimate Classic Wrestling on Fight Network. But certainly had a style that a lot of the veterans at the time felt this guy was going to be in a wheelchair by the age of 30 and worked the style that I think a lot of people watching today. I mean, it makes sense why this guy is, it's so hard for this guy to get around now. And he has certainly paid a very, very big physical toll. And you see the examples here of just these small shows where he was doing outrageous stuff and doing it pretty well on a nightly basis.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, The documentary really portrays him as the guy who obviously didn't have a great look, so he had to make up for it by abusing his body and developing an original character. These, you know, doing things that he can do that he wasn't born with.
And he explains why he left WCW for the second time, and he was just so upset coming off the ear incident with Vader that they... You know, he talks about this is the only industry where losing your ear could actually be a positive for his career, and that they could make money off of this real life angle that's fallen into their laps. And WCW chose not to do anything with it. And he just figured, I'm never going to get anywhere in this company as a result of this, and decided to leave. And that was where he hooked up with ECW, gave up a huge salary with WCW at the time, but talks about kind of having a bigger vision for himself and knew that WCW, there was that ceiling that he was never going to evolve past.
Yes, and citing, of course, ECW as the point of his career where he felt like he had his strongest promos, and they actually showed one of them like at length in this documentary. I'm sure on the extras you'll find even more. But it was great, I thought, to have so many people from so many parts of his career be able to speak about it. You know, Paul Heyman, obviously, talking about it, Mick Foley here in this portion, Joey Styles as well talking about it. Would have been nice to see some other ECW guys, but just even those guys alone, I think, added a lot.
Yeah, it was, it's great when, I mean, the WWE pretty much owns all the significant tape libraries out there, and this is one of the benefits of that, is that when you do sit down to do a guy's career retrospective, most of them, you have them from throughout their career where you can go through all of these different tape libraries.
I did find it surprising, though, when they got to the King of the Death matches from Japan, that they spent so much time on them because they didn't have that footage. Some of the only footage of his career that they did not have, yet they decided to spend a pretty good chunk of time talking about that stuff, showing only a couple pictures that they had the rights to.
Yeah, I don't know what... the whole situation is there, because, I mean, the IWA doesn't exist anymore in Japan, so I don't even know who would own that footage, because that same footage was heavily used by the WWF back in 97 when they were doing all those interviews with Jim Ross and Mick Foley, and they used it not only on television showing them in the King of the Death match, but they used it in their magazine as well, and really promoted that aspect of Mick Foley being the King of the Death match. And again, they had Terry Funk here to also explain that he saw something in this young wrestler, and they went over to this King of the Death match, which featured other guys. Dan Severn was in that tournament. I remember that was one of one of my buddies, when he first found tapes online, that was the first tape he ordered.
Huh.
And I think it's like so many people have watched that IWA King of the Death match just because of the legendary nature of that title and knowing that, you know, you had this familiar name in Mick Foley involved.
Which we actually have reviewed, you and I, John, as part of Stranglemania.
Oh, that's right.
ICP's Stranglemania. So go to our archives at lawradio.proboards.com and you can check that out. But I don't know if you also noticed, John, but just something that I did. Whenever they went to a shot of like a still photo, they shot it with a camera, of course, but like all around the photo was like red flannel. You know?
Yeah, I did notice that. That was a nice little touch.
To the point where, like, you know, yeah, it was basically like sort of a red flannel motif, obviously, because Foley wears that. He's wearing a red flannel shirt, like, right then and there. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, very good little attention to detail there. And then we kind of go into the whole WWE chapter of his career where he explains how it was really Jim Ross that was able to get him into the company. At that point in time, it would have been when J.J. Dillon was still the vice president of talent relations, and Ross was just an announcer at the time, but was really able to sell Vince McMahon on the idea of hiring this guy, Mick Foley, who was really completely against the prototype of guys that they would go after and sign. And it's interesting because you contrast that to today, and I think it would be even more difficult for Mick Foley to get signed today.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, we were talking about this at Ring of Honor, the fact that, you know, all these people who really enjoy Kevin Steen, great promo, can you know, a great brawler, very talented individual, but a lot of people, it's just the look is like this stop sign, and he really epitomizes to me where Mick Foley was in, you know, in that time period when it comes to trying to get into the WWE.
Totally.
And I don't know if Mick Foley gets hired today, which is, I think that's a lesson for a lot of people that, you know, you can't just necessarily judge, you know, not everyone should look the same, I don't think.
So he gets brought into the WWE, and of course,
oh, did you see when they scanned? And I don't know if this was a legit memo or not, but some of the name suggestions here that were thrown out to him, like Scarface, Muskrat Jack.
Muskrat Jack.
That's what it said on the paper.
God.
Muskrat Jack has just been thrown off the Hell in a Cell.
Yeah, and of course, Mason the Mutilator was another one.
This was right up there with Steve Austin has talked about this many times when he was switching over to the Stone Cold character, and then the names that they sent over to him by fax machine were like Chili McFreeze, like just these stupid names. Like this was a company. It's like these are the minds here coming up with new characters. Yeah. Chili McFreeze.
It could have been the
Stone Cold Chili McFreeze.
Well, business would have been very different, I thought. But yeah, that was it was cool to the point where they would show you know, Foley's getting fitted for that leather mask. A lot of cool behind the scenes photos and footage that you get to see here.
Yeah, and this was to me always a big positive was the fact that when Mick Foley came to the WWF, a lot of people knew him as Cactus Jack, but created this whole new character that he was really playing a very different character than Cactus Jack. He was like, you know, this tortured man under this mask, and it was completely different that you for a time you really got drawn into this character and separated himself from Cactus Jack.
And the fact that they did that paid off even more than they ever thought it would when they got into the Three Faces of Foley. And it was at some point, first of all, they go through the Mind Games match with Shawn Michaels, which Foley for a long time cited as his favorite match. And of course, Shawn Michaels gets to talk about it, and this is here the section where you hear comments from Punk as well saying it was one of his favorite matches.
Yeah, it's an excellent match.
It is.
If no one's ever seen that.
They didn't get into the finish, though.
The finish was
a DQ.
It was a DQ finish because
a shitty finish.
Yeah, they didn't really want to beat Mick Foley, but at the same time, yeah, really kind of lame finish too. It was a very solid match.
Anyway, so at some point, Foley mentions that Vince came to him and said that he had actually found his real life story much more interesting than, you know, this character that he had developed in Mankind. And I wasn't really watching wrestling at the time, but I would always hear about things that were happening. And this, when I heard about it, was like, holy shit, this is awesome. Like, for the first time,
a character was playing more than one. Like, it was, first of all, it was an admission of kayfabe. But secondly, it just, like, it's the idea that these guys aren't just the character that they are. They are multiple, I don't know, they're actors. It's the idea that these guys are actors and they can do a number of things. And to get to see your favorite different person. Like, imagine seeing Kane at one part of the show and then seeing Isaac Yankum in another part of the show and then fake Diesel. You know what I mean? No, that doesn't appeal to you.
That'd be awesome.
But I just think because, you know, coming from where wrestling was coming from before, how protective they were of none of that stuff ever existing.
Yeah.
To the point now where they were all three people involved in the same storyline, all three characters. I thought that was the coolest thing.
Well, yeah, and those interviews with Jim Ross and Mick Foley, I mean, still, like, that was 16 years ago, and you still remember them, and they were just so effective that it took this guy from just being a wrestling character into someone people really did care about.
Yeah.
And as Foley notes in this thing, it was Austin who predicted, you're going to be a babyface in just a couple of weeks.
Well, Dude Love was such a great contrast to Mankind, you know? Like, first of all, like, you get introduced to this guy who, like, has pet rats and, like, pulls out his hair, and all of a sudden it's I mean, Joseph Park and Abyss are completely inspired. I mean, I don't care what anyone says, they're completely inspired by what Mick Foley's done in his career.
Sure.
And you had a very similar dynamic back then with Dude Love, who is a completely different character than what Mankind was, but he portrayed Dude Love so well.
And it was, I think, something that really helped as well was the fact that, I mean, Dude Love was like this ridiculous character if you just look at it at face value. But because they had all this, like, home video footage where it was like, here he was wanting to be this guy and had this image. And if you remember, he cut this awesome promo at the time about the fact that, you know, he wanted to be Shawn Michaels, and look how he turned out. It was like this great story, and it was, there was this reality to it because you saw this actual footage of him wanting to be this character he came up with called Dude Love, and it was awesome to compare.
He became the guy who justified any kid's stupid backyard wrestling fantasies. You know what I mean? Like, because, like, Mick Foley was able to do this. Like, you know, who hasn't had their own SMC or, you know, film their own promos?
Did you ever jump off a roof?
I never did. I was a commentator.
Oh.
But I don't know. Did you? Did you do anything crazy?
No, I never jumped off a roof.
Were you involved in any, like, backyard wrestling?
No, I never got into that stuff. I didn't have SMC to join.
Did you ever film yourself, like, cutting a promo or anything like that?
No, I can't say I did. I mean, me and my buddies, when we worked together, we would have, like, wrestling matches at work in, like, this employees area, and it was I nearly killed myself once, and I stopped doing that.
Well, how did you almost kill yourself?
Well, we would set up, like, cushions and stuff, and you just do, like, my one buddy would choke slam everybody, and then there was one time I would do this move where I'd set up a chair, and then from the other side, I would run, and I would jump in the air and do, like, a somersault in midair over the chair and land on, like, the pillow in front. So I'm doing this once, and in midair, my fucking supervisor kicks this like metal trash can, like one of those big ones at a movie theater, right in front of my landing, and in midair I have to move and I land on the ground to avoid the garbage can.
Wait, your supervisor is trying to sabotage? Like,
he's trying to fuck up my spot.
Trying to injure your thing?
Yeah. Like, I could have landed on this thing and done who knows what to my back or something.
You were trying to... Oh, yeah, I know, because doing somersaults through...
Oh, the cushions, come on.
Would have been perfectly safe anyway.
Well, come on. I have no idea.
What move is that? I've never even heard of that move. Like a Rolling Thunder type of thing?
No. It wasn't on the ground.
Through the air.
Like, picture, like this was the chair, and then you run, and then just do a somersault, and then land on the ground.
That sounds idiotic.
Well, it was idiotic. I was like 15.
It doesn't even sound like a wrestling.
What were some spots that you guys had in SMC? Anything that stands out to you that was,
like,
stupid?
Like I said, I was the announcer and booker.
Yeah,
so
what did you watch? What did you book? What did you make the others do?
I didn't. Listen, we weren't a violent thing at all. Like, I would book really dumb angles. Like, you know, we had two sets of brothers and...
two sets of brothers.
No, sorry. One set of two brothers. And
what were they called?
their names were
Their names were, I don't want to give out their names.
Why? Well, what were
they? It was nothing. There was no real name. We called them by their last name, brothers. You know, the blank brothers.
The blank brothers.
Whatever. And I would book stupid angles where, you know, okay, so they're having this match. You would have hated it because they're having this match and they're both tagging in, attacking the other. And then all of a sudden, one of them, the babyface in peril trying to get the hot tag. And the other brother is reaching out his hand, trying to accept the hot tag. Instead, he gives him the finger. He gives him the finger, and then they turn on him. Like, after having a whole match where they were attacking.
Why do you think I would hate this?
Because you criticize this all the time. I criticize this all the time.
I want to see this.
This is so dumb.
Well, what kills me is you've let it out of the bag in the past that footage of this exists.
Yeah, well, that particular match, though, our camera operator, like, he double shot the record button, so he actually missed it. He missed most of the match and only got the middle finger.
Did that drive you into a career of production?
I was pissed off.
Making sure this that history is never lost again due to hitting a record button twice?
Yeah. Yes.
Who has all this footage? Does Farrah have it?
I don't know. I don't know who's got it.
What was her role?
She was
a wrestler or was she a
she was like a female she was like a valet.
Valet. Did she have a name?
I don't think so. Like we used never mind. This is so embarrassing. But you remember Shu? You remember my friend?
Yeah, of course.
Shu was having Shu had his own faction of like
the shoebox.
No. That's not bad.
No.
But he was like, he wanted to be a diva. Like, really badly. So he was in a faction just by himself, my friend.
He was in a faction by himself.
Yeah, this was his idea. He booked this. Like, anyway, so he was my friend Shu, who's a very interesting man.
Very successful guy, too.
Yeah, at this point, yeah, he's very successful, you're right. But anyway, back then, he really came up with this idea to start his own Divas faction by himself.
Wow.
And so I think he asked Farrah to join. Like, Farrah was like the only woman, the only female friend we had at that time. And when Farrah turned her down, she attacked her. Like, so we would shoot like backstage, like vignettes, like men beating women, basically.
Oh, man. You could have cut the best promo with, like, mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest of them all?
Oh, God.
Wow. That would have been great.
You should have been helping.
I wish I was. If I was 15 way and you were like...
If we were friends.
You sound like you had the coolest friends in high school.
No.
I would have told... If I went to your high school, I totally would have joined your thing.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you would have been the star of our company. But no, we were total losers. So yeah, like he would attack her in the backstage area. And then like another guy would like walk by and like he's like, "Hey, what are you doing? Stop." And then he would turn on her as well.
So, it was another girl.
No, it was another man.
Oh, another.
Yeah, so it'd be two dudes attacking woman.
They turn on Farrah.
Yeah. Like, it was just turn after
turn. Did she ever get her revenge? Did it build up to something? Did she have something? No, beat her up.
It was just the worst.
How many people were in this? Is this like a 10-person operation?
It would vary, but it would be like somewhere like, like 15. Something.
And where would you do this?
In the park.
In the park.
Like, for the public to see.
So this is like right out of the backyard.
Yeah, I suppose so.
The documentary.
But like, I don't even compare it to that because like, nobody took any real bumps. Like when we say like backyard wrestling, it was like, I'm gonna punch the air five centimeters away from your face, and you're going to softly roll to the ground.
There were never any mistakes, any accidents?
No, not really.
Wow, I remember when I was like 12 years old in elementary school, and I told this guy, Mark, who was a year older than me, he was a big guy. I was like, Yeah, just choke slam me on the snow. And he fucking did it. And I fucking lay there on the... It was like cement, but like so much snow. Like concrete snow that I thought it was like, it would be a good padding or whatever.
Concrete?
It was, no, but there was like, mean? There was like levels of, it wasn't like I was getting, I don't want to make it seem like I was choke slammed on concrete.
How much
it,
snow was there?
A few inches, like quite a few inches.
Okay.
But it hurts so badly. Like I'd never felt pain like that in my life. And I just lay there and it made the choke slam like the most devastating move when I would watch it on TV after that, because I was like, that
I'm sure, I mean, I'm sure a body slam would be the most devastating move if you took it.
Choke slam, there's, I think there's more velocity. Like you're just sending the guy down with like your momentum. Yeah, man, we're dumb when we're kids.
Yeah, we're idiots. Don't try this at home. Bodies.
But Mick Foley did, and a lot of people copied this afterwards. And there was also a lot of negative towards Mick Foley in terms of what he encouraged as kind of his gateway into wrestling, where people thought this guy just jumped off a roof and he got hired by WCW, which was not the case.
No,
and I think throughout his career, I think you can look back, Mick Foley was certainly a lot more than just a guy who could do bumps. I mean, this was a multifaceted performer who was an awesome promo, could have great matches without that stuff.
Yeah, went to school for proper training.
Exactly. And I think he always tried to get that across. But to the outsider, a lot of people just assumed that, well, this guy just did backyard wrestling and got hired, and he didn't have a body, so that's what I can do.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, a lot of people did not have the talent of Mick Foley and would kill themselves on camcorders.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their idea of getting into wrestling.
Three stages of hell light bulb.
Yeah, with their mom.
And C4 matches.
Where the buried alive match is match number two in a 2 out of 3 falls match, which makes no sense. But yeah, so he talks about Dude Love incorporating Cactus Jack into the WWF and his debut. And then something that Mick Foley would make really kind of a hallmark throughout his career was being able to take a lot of real moments and turn them into promos. And he talks about the night after WrestleMania 14, which would eventually start his heel turn, and a run with Steve Austin was where DX reformed with Sean Waltman debuting, and they just beat up Mick Foley and Terry Funk in a cage. And the crowd, after Foley's just lying down there, they start chanting for Austin for the next segment. And it's pretty much, well, just sweep these guys away and let's get on to the real star of the show. And Foley notes that he's like, this really affected me, but rather than get mad, I decided to put it in the back of my head because this could be a great promo. Like, that's how this guy thought.
That's a great idea. It's a great way to deal with stress, isn't it? In life in general, is it not?
I think
all this anger, I'm gonna release it at a time when it's beneficial to release it.
I think everyone needs kind of those outlets in life.
Everybody should be cutting promos, like, just to release their frustrations.
You don't seem like the type that gets angry, though.
I do see you
get angry. I do, but
you just don't pour beer on me.
That's true. That's always going to be the example, eh?
Yeah.
Wait, you're a pretty like even keeled guy, though. You don't get too.
I mean,
there's days I go in and I just rant to you about.
No,
things.
I mean, I would say definitely you're the more ill-tempered person of the two of us.
Yeah.
But like. You know, like you, if somebody like messes with me or messes with my friends, of course I'm going to get angry.
Yeah.
I would destroy them.
Do you hold on to grudges?
What type of grudges?
Someone.
Yeah, I do actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, would you if someone like punched me in the face?
I'll tell you what grudge that I still hold.
Oh, okay.
So
this is great. We're learning so much about you. I love
so
these kind of
there was like one time I was like out with my mom and her friend, and she had three kids, so like, you know, it'd be the three of us playing.
How old are you roughly?
I think I was 10.
Okay.
And we were like all in the mall, and like, you know, they were kind of watching us, but like we were all kind of just wandering the mall, like this section of the mall, wandering by ourselves. And so, you know, it'd been like maybe like, you know, I don't know, half an hour or something of just all of us kind of wandering by ourselves, but with like supervision from those. Actually, my mom wasn't there. It was my friend's or my mom's friend that was kind of supervising us. So then, you know, I'm like, well, you know, it's time to leave. Where is everybody? And I'd look everywhere. They're not there. Like, there's nobody there. Like, I'm 10 years old here. I'm looking for all these people. And
the mother's gone. The kids are gone. Everyone's gone.
Everybody's gone. And then, like, I'm like, oh, shit, like, was I abandoned? Am I now, what do you call that?
I don't know. I don't know what you call it. An abandoned child. What is that?
You could be in the U.S. You'd be a child of the state.
Okay, child of the. Well, am I a child of the state now? Actually, I was in the U.S. We were in L.A. at the time.
Well, there you
go. So I would have been.
So you're in a foreign area.
I wasn't.
I'd be scared shitless if I was 10 years old.
And then they
all alone in a foreign country.
And then this fucking bitch and her kids come out laughing. They're just like, ah, ha, 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 we played a trick on you. They decided to play hide and seek without letting me know.
Oh, shitheads.
And, yeah, I still hold a grudge over that.
Wow. Do you still know these people?
Yeah, I mean, when I say I hold a grudge, it's not like I get pissed off, like that pissed off.
You just revert.
Actually, now I think about it, I saw this woman, maybe like a few months ago, and like, I was very cordial. It was actually kind of nice. So maybe I don't hold grudges.
Give her a ride to the subway and you drop her off and like mark them somewhere.
That's a fucking great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Don't fuck around with
maybe,
Wei.
Maybe it explains
10
a
years
lot.
Old. So you've kept that one for 18 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I still have that.
Holy 19. Shit. 19 years. Well, that's what Mick Foley did here and then turned heel here. And this was when they aligned Mick Foley with Vince McMahon, and he was kind of Austin's first big opponent coming off of his title win at WrestleMania that year in 1998, and that's when Raw was really rolling at this time. They had surpassed Nitro in the ratings, and this was a really hot period for the company, and Foley goes over his matches with Austin in the April and May pay-per-views. They did 2 months in a row, and then after that, they moved Foley back to the Mankind character because he played Dude Love, like a heel Dude Love, as he was aligned with Vince McMahon. And he thought that there was a lot of character changes at this point, so that when the Hell in a Cell match got made with him and The Undertaker, he felt it had hurt his character, having all these character changes, and it was a lot for the audience to digest. And he was kind of felt he wasn't worthy of this match with The Undertaker at this point at that King of the Ring event, which
did it
is
feel
interesting.
That way, did it feel that way to you as a viewer?
It felt that it was, they were doing a lot of, you know, movement with this Foley character. It was a lot to go from this heel Dude Love character to effectively like a babyface Mankind all within the span of a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Like he was a heel on the May pay-per-view. 4 weeks later, he's Mankind, Hell in a Cell with The Undertaker. Mm-hmm. But that match, of course, do you remember this one?
Hell in a Cell?
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever seen it.
Oh, it was in Pittsburgh. And Mankind got thrown off the cage.
Oh, yeah, wow.
I have to imagine this is the last time Mick Foley will ever talk about this match. Because he goes out of his way to say how much he hates being asked about this match. Well, but at the same time, it's like, you tell everyone on this DVD the fact that the snooka moment of diving off the cage changed your life. Those are his words, and he wants to create a moment that would live with people forever. So I can't have any sympathy for a guy that is well remembered for something. There are wrestlers that would literally die to be remembered like that. So every time Mick Foley says that he hates always being asked about this match, I'm sorry. I have no tears for this guy.
I'm pretty sure he talks about this every time he does a stand-up gig, doesn't he? Like, this is what he's known for.
Yeah.
This is his life's, I don't know, achievement, as weird as that sounds.
Oh, well, I think his issue is that he feels when people look back at his career, he's going to be defined by that night and taking these big stunts. And I think there's a part of him that does feel that he was much more than that night, that he did a lot of great stuff. And I would agree with that. There's much more. And he always said, you know, I would much rather people ask me about the Shawn Michaels match than the Undertaker match, because he was much more proud of that match. But, you know, you can't dictate your legacy.
No, it's like Brett, you know, kind of being asked about the screw job over any of his other accomplishments in his career.
Sure. And I think Brett has the same issues that doesn't always want to be defined by that. But to me, I would much rather this be the case of this, where people still talk about this 15 years later, versus when WCW did like this triple cage match at Slamboree 2000 and Canyon got thrown off the top through the ramp and no one would remember that.
No.
No one remembers that at all.
I think it's... Yeah, certainly. I think it's better to be remembered for something than, you know, not be remembered.
And I think lots of people, they're going to remember the Hell in a Cell because it was beyond a spectacle.
Exactly. And, like, I don't know, maybe Foley somehow sees this as a bit of a negative. I mean, maybe he doesn't, but, like, to me,
I've always seen this match and this moment as one of the most emotional times for me that I've experienced as a wrestling fan. The first time that I had seen this match was in highlight form back on Sunday Night Heat when they would do kind of like flashbacks to previous matches, and they would get guys to like kind of commentate about the matches. These would be like kind of like 5-minute little segments that they would do talking about this match. And I saw one where, you know, it had a bunch of people talking about Hell in a Cell. And I've always, you know, found it incredibly emotional that, okay, here's this man who fell off of a fucking, 5-story cage. Okay. At that point, he gets taken to the back and he's like, I just fell off, but fuck this. Like, these people still don't have their money's worth yet. So I'm going to climb up to that cage and I'm going to fucking fall through it again just so these people somehow feel like, you know, they've got their money's worth. And then not only that, I'm going to get a concussion. I'm going to lose my tooth. And then I'm going to fall through a thing of thumbtacks. And I'm going to take a number of tombstones before I feel like these people have had their money's worth. Like, I mean, that type of dedication to an audience is it transcends transcends pro wrestling. Like, it's this man giving out his body for the entertainment value of a number of people, and I've always I really respected that.
It was even going back here on this DVD and watching it, I mean, it's still like I'm stunned watching these bumps. Like, this is, there's a very good chance this man could have died on a live pay-per-view.
Absolutely.
It was just insane to watch.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I mean, it's brought up here the fact that, you know, Vince McMahon told him after this that, you know, you cannot ever do this again. And you really did set the bar at this height.
Yeah.
Where it really created this environment where it was like, you do not end up, like, a guy getting a concussion, for instance, after that, you know. How do you not finish a match when Mick Foley did that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And for every, it took them years afterwards of Hell in a Cell matches where you had to be conditioned that you weren't going to get that kind of a bump.
Mm-hmm.
And that would always be in people's minds, is instantly thinking they're going to get that. And that's what would be, everything would be measured against. So, I mean, it's very hard to watch this kind of a match, knowing that I don't think Mick Foley was ever quite the same after this match, of all the damage he took in this match that he readily admits to. And the fact is, there's no way this could ever happen today. Like, this would have been, that match would have been, they would have never allowed him, first of all, in that position to be thrown off the top of a cage. That's like, this match could never, ever happen today.
Mm-hmm. You know, when talking about, like, this match, I was actually a much, and this bump, I was actually a much bigger fan of the second Hell in a Cell match that he had with Hunter, where they did that.
And it was gimmicked.
The back body drop through the cage, and it was onto, like, a gimmick padded floor. I really liked that bump way better because it, to me, it fits in line with what the idea of pro wrestling is, in that it's supposed to be a work. It's not supposed to hurt.
I mean,
that probably did hurt anyway, but, to me, the art...
It was done much smarter that way. It still visually looked incredible.
Exactly.
And without, you know, a fraction of the risk first involved.
That, to me, is the art of pro wrestling in the first place, is to make it look like it hurt without it actually hurting.
Yeah, very much. I'm very much the same. It's like you're supposed to be able to, you know, use the advantages of pro wrestling to convey that. They have The Miz and Sheamus here discussing watching it at home, and spend quite a bit of time on it here. And then afterwards, kind of Mick Foley kind of putting a lot more comedy into his character. And this would be
citing the difficulties, of course, with his, his injuries.
Yeah. And he had a lot of limitations after this. But after the 98 Survivor Series, they had just put the title on The Rock, and the plan was Rock and Austin for WrestleMania, and they needed a bridge before that, and that's where Mankind came in, and this would be the exact same spot he'd be in a year later with Triple H, where these, in Rock and Hunter, when the title was put on them, they really needed someone to solidify them in that top spot, and Mick Foley was the go-to guy, and that to me was always one of the biggest values of a Mick Foley, someone that, you know, is going to do everything to get somebody over, is not going to take shortcuts, and kind of focus on themselves. And those kind of people were extremely rare at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So they go through all the Rock matches, including the winning the title, which was in December of 98, which was, of course, the infamous match where they gave away the result on Nitro. And the result was everyone who was watching Nitro said, shit, there's a title change? I'm going to watch that. Mm-hmm. And then going into the Royal Rumble that year where the Rock destroyed Mick Foley with countless chair shots to the head, and this was outlined in Beyond the Mat pretty well. And Foley flat out in this documentary talks about the fact he didn't find this match too entertaining. There were way too many chair shots, and it was just, didn't like the match at all.
Yeah. They also had clips of The Rock talking about, was he talking specifically about this match, or was he just... He was, wasn't he?
I think so.
And I found The Rock to not be... didn't sound very genuine in his interviews. What I mean by that is it just seemed like he was in typical Hollywood junket mode where
Mick Foley would always bring it.
Like, just he was talking a lot more like a celebrity talking to Entertainment Tonight than contrasting him to Mick Foley talking here, where Mick Foley definitely seemed more like a real person. And because I also expected, The Rock to show a bit of regret for what happened in this match, but none of that kind of really came through. It was just more like, we had a great match. It was a very hard-fought battle, and, stuff like that.
Yeah, those are all clips from a while back when they interviewed The Rock. So it's like, this was not like a new interview shot for this documentary. Right. So,
but even if it was new, I don't know if he would necessarily be any different in his interviews.
Yeah, it was, at the time, I mean, Mick Foley had, talked about the fact in his book that, he was really upset that, they had agreed to like a few chair shots, and then Rock just kind of played off the crowd and decided to just pretty well go into business for himself, which, it's, quite a selfish thing when you think about it that, this match calls for my opponent to take more damage to the head.
It's a hard.
And didn't come to check on him afterwards. That was another thing that drove Foley really upset, and that there was a bit of a, tension between these two for a while.
It's a very difficult match to watch, and a very difficult scene to watch in Beyond the Mat, which just beautifully, visually tells the story of the trauma of that match.
They then lead in, of course, to The Rock and Foley eventually teaming up, and that goes into the This Is Your Life segment, which is the second highest rated quarter hour in the history of Raw.
And what is the first?
The first one was in June of 99, and it was a title change they did. It was the night after the King of the Ring, with Steve Austin beating The Undertaker for the title, which is the highest rated quarter
hour.
Why does
that never get mentioned? Why does that match never get mentioned?
It's just one of those things, WWE history, where it's just...
they would rather this to be remembered, the Rock and Tuck?
I think this fits in very much... this segment is brought up so many times. I mean, that Austin-Undertaker match, when's that ever been brought up? That it's, this is a story where it's like, well, this is a segment that it was just a... It's got. I think it's much more romanticized to say this is the highest rated segment in Raw history.
It's kind of strange.
Well,
it's undeniable that Rock and Foley certainly had a great chemistry as a comedic duo.
They talked about his book, even having Judith Reagan here, who is with Reagan Books, talking about getting involved with Mick Foley, how he wanted to write his own book. And they did this great fan of all these great books, and you go from like Catcher in the Rye over to Mick Foley's book, that these are all all these classic books. Yeah. And then right even better is they had his three autobiographies of his four that they show on screen. I don't know where Countdown to Lockdown was.
I don't know.
Oh, that's strange. I guess maybe all the copies were gone.
Do you think they would have shown it if it was called something else?
Yeah, I think they probably would have, because it's not like TNA put that book out.
Right.
It was just, it's centered around a lockdown event, but for whatever reason,
I don't think as many WWE fans know what lockdown even is.
Yeah, maybe they thought it was like Countdown to Mick Foley overseas, and there was like a bomb threat or something, and he had to be in lockdown.
Sure.
Anyway, they also mention in late 1999, when Foley was about to retire, and in an interesting trivia note, he was here on a Monday morning and did an episode of Off the Record with Michael Landsberg, where he stated on the show his retirement, and it was going to air the next day. And then that night, he got to Raw in Buffalo, was scheduled to make his retirement announcement, but that was also when Steve Austin went down, needed neck surgery, and they were able to talk Foley into sticking around for a few more months. And I don't even know if that off the record aired. It might have, but he had made his announcement on off the record that he was retiring, and then everything changed within literally the same day. And that went into his feud with Triple H, which was just, I thought, an excellent program at the time. Their match at the Royal Rumble was many people's match of the year in 2000. Yep. They followed it up with the Hell in a Cell you mentioned in February, which was supposed to be his retirement match.
And it should have been his retirement
in 2000, 13 years ago, was his retirement.
That was his proper retirement. I mean, from active...
many people would probably... That was, you know, a great send-off for him. He was done, lost to Hunter, and within 3 weeks, they called him to do WrestleMania, and... When you have the chance to main event WrestleMania and get a six-figure payoff, it's very tough to take the high moral road of honoring a wrestling retirement, and he came back.
Right, but Mick Foley does regret that, and he cites that in this DVD. He regrets coming back at Mania and kind of ruining what was a really great moment at No Way Out the month prior.
I don't know if it ruins the moment. I mean, it's...
I think it does.
I think he's, you know, at the end of the day...
What?
Would you say no to, you know... $300,000 to do one match?
I would.
You would.
I mean, if I was Mick Foley at this point...
I wouldn't. I'd be a sellout.
I mean, if I was Mick Foley at this point, I don't know if I necessarily need $300,000. I feel like maybe for him, it was more of a duty because the company needed me.
I think the paycheck had a big thing to do with it.
$300,000? Come on. Maybe.
That's at the low... It might have been even more than that. I mean, that was a show that did almost a million buys.
Maybe
he would have got a big chunk of that.
Yeah. And plus, the match was just so, like, not...
It was not a memorable match at all. Not a very good WrestleMania at all that year.
Foley even says it himself. He was not very inspired for it during that performance.
So, he says after that WrestleMania match, he was determined he was never going to return to television. And to show how serious he was, he shaved his head. Because now I look hideous. And I could never go on TV with a bald head.
You shaved your head.
Do I look hideous?
No, I think you've been on TV more now that you shaved your head.
Maybe that was the problem. Maybe I was hideous before, and now I'm just unsightly. But nonetheless, he got. I always thought Mick Foley with the shaved head. I thought it was a good look for him. I've always think he looks terrible with his hair looking all disheveled and shit.
I don't think so, but I thought
I liked the bald look.
I liked it for a new change in character. I mean, you know, something to cite a new era in his career.
And
shaved head.
I have a feeling that Foley definitely had a big say in this being such a significant part of the documentary is his run as the commissioner in 2000, which he clearly regards as probably the highlight of his career were these like 6 months as commissioner.
I was incredibly surprised by that because I really don't remember much of him as the commissioner.
Were you watching at this point?
I was, I was. I really didn't think that this whole thing was that special.
There was some great comedy at this point. I mean, I enjoyed Mick Foley in this role quite a lot.
Man, I just don't think, like, watching these skits on this DVD, I really don't think that they stand the test of the time.
Really?
No.
I found them enjoyable at the time. I also had just watched a John Cena promo the night before when I watched this, but...
Maybe at the time, but I mean, certainly right now, I don't know. I didn't find them very funny. But it's also important to note that the WWF logos are unedited now.
Yeah, they've got that all cleared away now, so that's not going to be a problem, which was, to me, always annoying. Yeah. I always hated that. I thought it really distracted me when you'd see this giant blur over, you know, ring posts or whatever. But he talks about this role. It ended in December because the whole idea was that, you know, this would have to build up to a match. At some point, it has to build to something. And they were going to have him wrestle at WrestleMania, the big Astrodome show, WrestleMania X7.
Oh, he was
going
to come back the year after?
He was going to do a match. And he said, no, I'm retired and I will not go against my word. So they took him out as commissioner. He ended up being a referee, if you remember, at that year's WrestleMania with Vincent Shane.
Yep.
And years later, he said he deeply regretted that he ended up coming back anyway years later. He's like, I should have just done it because I would have made a lot of money at that WrestleMania. I mean, let's be honest here. He stood up a lot more than others would for a wrestling retirement. Something no one takes seriously.
Yeah, I guess. But,
Wei Ting is disgusted at anyone who comes back.
I mean, I'm not in that position, so I can't really say. I don't know what finances he's got to pay off, but maybe
his children. You got to put them all through school.
I understand that, but I mean, you know, you would hope that Mick Foley, even at that point in his life, was, you know, pretty well off.
Let's not forget. I mean, he was like, at this point, 34, 35 years old. Like,
yeah. So?
That's a long time still. You're saying, like, this guy could live another 45, 50 years.
Right. No. Okay.
Without any money? Like, that's... No one makes enough money to live that long. With kids?
Some people do.
Well, some do. But you got to be very careful. Then he talks about leaving the company in late 2001, where they just parted ways, and he thought it'd be best if he just separated ties with the company, went out, did some of his own projects, came back in 2003, where he was the referee for a Triple H, Kevin Nash, Hell in a Cell match, which actually did a very good pay-per-view number with Mick Foley inserted into it. And then it fast forwards to the end of 2003, where he started his feud with Randy Orton and lost a lot of weight, worked WrestleMania the following year with The Rock against Evolution, and then had what he considers the best match of his career at Backlash in Edmonton against Orton, which was, many would say, his last really great match, which was highlighted very well here and was great.
Yeah.
So, nothing to add.
No, not really.
Good match.
I think it's quite a stamp of approval for him to say that that was his favorite match. I mean, above the Shawn Michaels match, above the Sting match that he had.
Yeah, it was an excellent match. It was like 25, 26 minutes. I remember that match very. That was the co-main event, and then the main event, you had a rematch with Benoit, Michaels, and Triple H. It was an excellent pay-per-view. And then they kind of just wrap things up talking. We hear from Punk, where he tells the Samoa Joe story about the Foley recommending them coming back to face Edge in Chicago.
You forgot to mention there's also some a segment there talking about his charity work.
Yeah, with Rain.
Yeah,
working with Dee Snider, a school that's opened up in his name.
Yeah, a school in his and his wife Colette's name. I some of this stuff I really didn't know.
Yeah, something he's been always very, very much involved with.
Yeah.
That WrestleMania match we were at with Edge.
WrestleMania
and,
22.
Yeah, and the big spot, of course, being the flaming table spot, which Miz said he'd never seen anything like that in his life. A flaming table. Which makes me...
WWF, not ECW.
I guess so. And then it comments on the difficulties of retiring for good and always coming back, discusses his current role with the company and how he'll never be asked to wrestle again now. And that was only a recent thing because I think that when him and Punk were doing those promos last year, the idea was they could maybe get a match out of this. And they were even discussing like the December pay-per-view last year would be in Brooklyn, that they could do Punk and Foley. And Punk actually ended up getting hurt there, but it never happened. And I think they realized that Foley is just not healthy enough to do a singles match.
Didn't he even have trouble doing that elbow at the Hall of Fame? Elbow on Jericho, or at least he was hesitant to do it.
I think so, yeah.
Because he didn't know if hitting an elbow drop would mess him up at all.
Yeah, he's just, I mean, for those that have been around him, I mean, he is definitely, you know, in not the greatest of shape and should not be wrestling
and
anymore.
Honestly, like, coming back for one match, what is it going to mean in the grand scheme of things?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Nothing.
I think it helps that the WWE has kind of put their foot down, so it's not on Foley, as opposed to, well, the door's always open and it's up to Foley, who would probably relent and want to do it when he had some idea for a program.
But
or
with
something.
That said, I mean, you know, you and I, and like I think every wrestling fan is in agreement that he still has so much to offer for the company, for a lot of the younger talent, and especially now in this current run, he's been extremely underutilized in whatever roles he's been put in.
It seems that there was definitely a turning point in the company, and you could maybe go back to 2005, where, and he's outlined this in his books, where he went to Vince McMahon in 2005, said, I'm leaving for TNA, and WWE came back with a giant offer, so he stuck around for a few more years, and then went to TNA, and it seemed that after that point, it was like Mick Foley was no longer part of our team, so to speak.
Sure.
And when he came back, I mean, it's just painfully obvious on television. I mean, this guy is not held at the same level of an Austin or a Rock or a Triple H.
He's playing Santa Claus. So.
Even a Jericho. I mean, Mick Foley is kind of just, to many people, he's just, I think for a younger fan base, would have no idea unless they watch something like this of, oh, wow, this guy was like a main event talent at one point during the company's hottest run at this point in the late 90s, early 2000s. And it's just, I mean, his Hall of Fame induction almost wasn't even televised.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Could you imagine that happening to Hunter?
No, it's absolutely unbelievable. But the fact that
that's weird in and of itself, of just Hunter was just so complimentary to this guy. And it's just interesting.
What's the real story?
I don't know. You hear stories of Hunter not always being the biggest Mick Foley fan, but he certainly was on this DVD.
Right, yeah. But I mean, don't you think that they both, you know, regardless of how they might feel, but don't you think they might have a mutual respect for...
I don't doubt that they do.
Yeah.
But it's just a weird kind of relationship you look at with those two, and by extension with the WWE and Mick Foley. I think Foley feels much happier in WWE than he did towards the end at TNA. I think he got to TNA, he was very excited about that company and being a difference maker, but then whether it was Hogan and Bischoff coming in and just changes to the company, I think TNA wore on him.
Yep.
And he came back, and I think he's just happy he's with the company, but I just think that there's a lot you could still benefit from Mick Foley in a non-physical capacity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's just not kind of presented as this legend. He's kind of just this kind of goofy part of the show who shows up every couple of months.
I mean, to me, the man's strength was not just about what he could do in the ring or, you know, to his body. It was just about his mind and how...
Oh, one of the best.
And how he could communicate so much emotion through his acting, his promos, and, like, just, you know, being able to do interviews like this in this documentary. Like, he's perhaps the most... likable, relatable person in the industry.
They do discuss him doing his comedy shows as well, with the best comment being his best friend John Imbriani, who says, "Yeah, he's getting better."
Well, you and I have seen his comedy shows, John, and they're not... I didn't find them so much, you know, a stand-up comedy as
yeah, and he goes out of his way to not label himself a stand-up comedian. No. He feels he's a storyteller, very much like Kevin Smith,
which is what I want.
Yeah, you
know, I don't necessarily want to hear punchlines from... I mean, I do kind of. I want him to make jokes about TNA. I think that's very funny, but I go because I want to spend some time with this guy, Mick Foley, and just talk about his career and his life. And
a great writer and a great storyteller. I mean, those are his strengths, and I think he plays to those.
We didn't really talk about the book too much, but I mean, like, that the success of that book really paved the way for an industry on its own of wrestlers writing books.
Completely changed the perception, at least amongst publishers, that wrestling fans will not only buy books, but, like, they can read.
Yep.
And that was a big...
And that wrestlers can write them themselves.
Yeah. Well, some wrestlers can. The right wrestlers can. Others are yikes. But Mick Foley, absolutely. That, to me, is just as big a legacy with Foley, was just creating this kind of sub-industry and licensing stream for wrestling companies.
Because, all these people have lived, pretty incredible lives, you know what I mean? And
you have a big audience that loves this information.
Like, we're at the point now where even, Hardcore Holly, who never really, you know, was a top star in any company, is able to write something incredibly compelling and, I don't know, of value to wrestling fans everywhere.
Oh, yeah, sure. And, I mean, I always have enjoyed his books. And some people are like, oh, man, he's come out with 4 autobiographies. It's like, I've enjoyed all of his books. Very much. I mean, I just think he's a really great writer, and you really enjoy just his storytelling and stuff. I find it very captivating. And it just kind of ends with Foley acknowledging he's in pain. It's not going to get better, but he's accepted that. And he ends it with a Larry David quote, which you must have liked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So pretty good.
Pretty good. So there you go. It was a pretty extensive look at his career. Again,
2.5 hours.
Yeah. Right? I didn't think it dragged, though.
I didn't think so either.
I'm glad they went so out of their way to find a lot of people and, you know, cover a lot of parts. Rather, there weren't any particular areas where I felt they really glossed over or anything like that.
Well, outside of TNA, of course.
Well, there was no TNA, so they didn't technically gloss over it. I understand why that is.
Of course.
You're not going to get A, footage, or B, it serves WWE no purpose to shine a light on them. At the same time, it's like, who is your audience here that you are aiming at? And do you really believe that they have no concept of what TNA is?
What is there to really say? I mean, I went to the competition and...
I think it, you could have acknowledged it even if it was for 2 minutes.
He just didn't do anything memorable. Like, nobody looks back at his run in the, what is it, the main event Mafia? Was he in that?
No, he was the opposite.
Okay, whatever.
Feuding with them.
Like, nobody looks back to that match with Flair. Like, nobody talks about any of that.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I don't know. Sometimes I find it's almost, it is somewhat insulting that you just don't acknowledge it as if people will just, I don't know. But it's,
yeah.
It is what it is. Yeah. I didn't think for a second they would acknowledge it.
What do you give the DVD?
I give this one a 7. I thought it was good.
Yeah. I give it a solid 7 as well. Like I said, I mean, if you're already familiar with the Foley story, a lot of this will be repetitive for you. But it was, you know, it was done well. And I think there's absolutely more value to this if you're a newer fan or you didn't read his books and want to know more about this guy.
Yeah. So
not as good as the CM Punk, obviously.
No, but. I think the CM Punk one has really raised people's expectations of what they expect from these DVD releases. And I think it forces the WWE that, you know, especially when you're going to redo a lot of these kind of retrospective DVDs, that
to
give people a big incentive to want to buy these.
Take a new angle. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So at this point as well, we're going to include an interview I did with Mick Foley a while back. This we actually shot for a one-on-one interview with the Fight Network, and this was nearing the end of his run in TNA, and it was when he was on a book tour for Countdown to Lockdown. So it's a bit of a lengthy chat here with Mick Foley, but talking about a lot of a wide variety of topics. But just keep in mind when this took place, it was when he was just nearing his end with TNA and before returning to the WWE. Let's chat a bit about the current book tour you're on right now. And my first question was kind of just comparing it to your initial promotion for Have a Nice Day back in 99. And kind of you've been very much embraced by the literary world. You've had a number of books come out. I mean, do you find a big difference with media acceptance now here in 2010 compared to that initial coming out?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if I'd go so far as say embraced as maybe accepted.
Sure.
But I think in 1999, it was the first... you know, book out of the gate that received a wide publication, and it was just like an onslaught of media, and I kind of got spoiled. Like, I thought, well, of course I'm supposed to be on, you know, American national talk shows. Like, this is the way it's supposed to be. And 2001's Foley's Good was even compounded, largely because I was featured in an interview in the New York Times, and I didn't realize how relevant they were. And as, you know, the New York Times rolled, so did the rest of the world. In the literary world, it's tough. It's actually tougher now. It's tougher to get people to bite on Wrestler Writes a Book because it's not the first or even the second time. So I have gotten a lot of positive coverage because of some of the themes in the book, but it's not just out there for the taking just because I have a book out there.
Was that kind of a cognizant part on your part, writing this book, of including certain topics that you knew were going to go outside of just the pro wrestling bubble of that audience that was going to gravitate towards this book regardless?
Actually, it's a yes and no question. I'll give you the no first, is that the subjects covered that are in the book, Countdown to Lockdown, are in there because I really thought they were important, and there were some issues that I hadn't discussed in other books, largely, you know, the deaths of so many young wrestlers, and I wanted to do something a little more substantive on the steroid issue. But the chapter I did write that was specifically to try to get media attention was called Name Dropping, in which I had like 15, 16 stories about meeting celebrities in all different walks of life. I thought I had something to appeal to every demographic, and then my editor had to break the news to me that I had a 25,000-word chapter in the middle of a 100,000-word book that actually had a narrative, so we had to lose name-dropping. So I did write those specifically to get media attention, and then we didn't publish it.
So is it a more informed media now that you find as opposed to 11, 12 years ago?
Well, in some cases, it might be a more misinformed media, or maybe a media, and you know, that searches Wikipedia instead of doing real research. And Wikipedia, as you know, can be very misleading because anybody can log onto it. So, It's real. What's been really nice, especially here in Canada, is I'm getting a lot of cool questions and a lot of things that are not just taken from Wikipedia. Like, people have done their homework and are asking me things I'm interested about. I know we were talking earlier about the fact that you knew I had lunch with Trish Stratus. That's kind of selective tweeting, you know? I mean, people talk about their rights to privacy. In this case, it was like, Trish, do you mind if I tweet this? No, Mick, do you mind if I tweet it? Because I'm really happy to see Trish, and it makes people feel good to know that wrestlers are connecting and staying in touch even after they part ways with the company.
November the 15th of 1999, you did an interview here in Toronto that actually never aired, where you were going to announce your retirement on Raw later that night in Buffalo,
99,
New York.
Okay. Yes,
yeah,
yes,
99.
Okay.
And it's 11 years later. I mean, you go back to that time. I mean, mentally, were you finished at that point, or was it simply that you were done for that period of time in your life?
I really thought I was finished, and this will give you a little bit of an indication as to Vince McMahon's character. When I told him I was having trouble getting around, he said, "Well, Mick, you know, you need to lose some weight. You feel a lot better." And then I told him it was actually, you know, some memory issues, and he said, "You've just had your last match." I said, "I have." He says, you know, he didn't want to jeopardize me that way. And that night, I believe Al Snow and I won the tag team championships from Bob and Crash Holly. He goes, "Why not go out on top?" And as far as I was concerned, that was my last match. And I believe, you know, we were going to announce it because it was, I don't remember the particulars. And it was only because of the neck injury suffered by Stone Cold Steve Austin that we put it off for, I guess at that point, it was 3 months, and then I ended up coming back at WrestleMania, and then 4 years after that, I just started participating in a never-ending sequence of comeback matches. But at the time, yeah, I definitely meant it, and I meant it in 2000, and did stick to it for 4 years.
And that time period, I mean, when a lot of people thought that Mick was winding down at the end of 99, you had those series of matches with Triple H, which really, I mean, Hunter was getting pushed at that time, but it was really, everyone looks at those matches as the ones that solidified him on top. And that's kind of been a theme throughout your career, whether it be, you know, later working with Randy Orton or just putting together these storylines that at the end of the day, we're going to have a new star here. And you're in an industry right now where the incentive for a performer to do that really isn't there. It's giving up my spot, where does that put me? It only lowers me. I mean, you've been very unselfish in trying to elevate new talent, looking at that next generation in an industry that oftentimes promotes being selfish.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. And I have to admit, I don't think I've been successful in that since I've come to TNA. I don't know. I haven't had that one signature program with a younger guy, unless you consider Abyss a younger guy, which he's not. I mean, Abyss is, a seasoned veteran. I don't think I'm good enough anymore. You know, I don't know if I still have the cachet to really help somebody along in that respect, but I still look at that as my long-term goal, to help establish new stars, even if it's not by getting in the ring and competing against them.
Let's chat about the book. It all centers around this one match with Sting from Lockdown of 2009. My first question is why Sting and that specific match?
You know, that was an opportunity that came my way. Again, I didn't know what my role was going to be when I got to TNA. I mean, I did a match in January of 2009 as part of a six-man, but I really considered the match with Sting in April to be my real, TNA debut / comeback match. I thought it was really fascinating because Sting was largely responsible for putting me on the mainstream map. I mean, maybe I would have gotten there eventually anyway, but I really felt like it was a series of key matches I had with Sting in 91 that helped establish me. Looking back on it, and I think I mentioned this in my first book, Sting, I wasn't told I was just coming in for a few weeks. And that was the knowledge that Sting had. Here's a guy coming in for a few weeks. There's going to be a succession of guys who are going to wrestle Sting in very short-lived feuds. And here I was proposing all these outrageous moves and matches. And, I remember Sting like, "Hey, wait a second." And I don't mean to make him sound bad, because this is the only story he's ever going to sound, bad in, where you expect Sting to go 50-50 with a guy who just got here? Yeah, I was pretty driven, and maybe that drive made me, borderline delusional. I was looking at some footage you guys had of my days in Global, That was actually filmed, you know, at the exact same time that I was making my debut in WCW. It didn't even occur to me that trying to work for both, you know, national companies, because we thought at the time that Global was going to be a national company, would be a bad idea. And I remember getting my contract offer from Magnum TA and thinking it was low. And I said, Magnum, you watch me wrestle, you know, there may not. He had said that it was like a carrot, just kind of like an incentive to get to that next year when I could start making good money. And I said, Magnum, I said, you see me wrestle, there may not be a next year for me. And so I held out and ended up, you know, getting in that $3,000 a week range, which was like the promised land at the time. But no doubt, the Sting matches were instrumental, and I thought it would be, I thought I could really come up with a compelling storyline on why we were getting in the ring again. And although time may make this argument look ridiculous, at the time when I was doing the storyline with Sting, I thought we had as good a storyline as WWE did, if not better. Although I think, as it turns out, that brand name WWE and the you know, phenomenon that is WrestleMania is just going to be much more powerful than anything we were or currently are capable of putting out there.
Well, that has been a problem for TNA, of trying to take that television audience and get them to pay-per-view. And reading this book, like, I watched Lockdown initially, and by the time we got to the climax of the book, like, I really wanted to see this match. Yeah. And do you think that there's elements that can be taken from this very simple story of a guy who's questioning, do I still have it, and get that onto the television and present that? I think at times TNA, it's almost, you overthink things, and it's sometimes the simplest stories are what connect to the broadest audience.
You know, the fault I have, and I've said this a bunch of times, so I'm not concerned with, you know, sounding too negative towards my current employer, is that we try to do too much.
Yeah.
That we don't need to do that much, and that I think if we focused more on the wrestling and had less stories going on simultaneously, that the stories we do tell would make more sense. And I know we've got the guys to do the wrestling. We've got guys who would love to go in there and put in the minutes. And I think it's proven that when you put great wrestlers like Beer Money against great wrestlers like the Machine Guns and give them time to actually create that, you know, they can leave this incredible footprint out there. But I think when we rush things and try to do too much, and specifically when we try to create 8 stories every month for pay-per-view matches, that we end up doing, you know, a poor job of long-term building.
I have one question I want to ask about a polarizing figure with the initials VR. That'd be Vince Russo, a guy who you have worked with dating way back. From the outside looking in, fans will look at TNA, that they've hovered around that 1.0, 1.1 ratings pattern on Spike TV. Pay-per-view business is not at a level, I think, that would be quantified as successful. If this were a sports team, you look at the head coach, and I think that's why Vince Russo gets a lot of the criticism.
Yeah.
What is the other side of Vince Russo that people are either not getting because it doesn't seem to be translating to the tangibles, right, that being numbers?
You know, it's a small field of people who've written television for wrestling successfully, and it's a lot more difficult than it looks from the outside. I said in 99, when Vince wasn't even working for us, in a WWE book, that I really respected his ideas. I thought he was a great idea guy, but that he needed a little bit of guidance. I made my opinion known. We should have more wrestling, less storylines.
Yeah.
On nights when we do that in Impact, I think we have great shows. On nights when we don't, you don't remember a thing about the show. I like Vince as an idea guy. I mean, I specifically had an idea relating to my book, and within 15 seconds, Vince came up with the idea of Brian Kendrick attending my book signing instead of other people that I would have had disrupting my book signing. I think he's a really creative person, and that's an incredibly stressful job. I wouldn't want it. I wouldn't want to have to create time and time again. But because Vince is a writer and was never a wrestler, unless you count that title run he had in WCW, I think he puts too much focus on the writing and doesn't understand that it should be, this is just a major difference in opinion. I think the focus should be more on wrestling. less on writing, but Vince as a writer is going to be more prone to that. So I don't think it's Russo. I think somebody has to be guiding the ship.
Do you ever feel, and this goes for WWE as well, that they're almost at the mercy now of producing so many hours of television that the art of the fan actually wanting to see something is sometimes lost in this sea of content time after time, where pay-per-view comes and goes, and suddenly it's the next night, boom, it's another pay-per-view in 3-4 weeks.
That's my complaint. I wish we would just abandon the monthly pay-per-view format. I think we could build much better characters. I think we'd have better television that would be compelling, that wouldn't have to be abandoned, after a few weeks. And I look at the days after lockdown, where I became the guy, you know, trying to get through the metal detector with the championship belt on. You know, the guy at the deli with the Stitcheroonies saying, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to make your day. I could have been that guy for 6 months, you know, and instead, you know, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, I'm defending the belt in a four-way, a five-way, and then a month after that, it's a King of the Mountain, and then I'm wrestling Kurt Angle in a singles. And it's just really hard to build characters, or in this case, to tweak characters when you're trying to hit that home run every single month. I don't like it. I just wish we would kind of be pioneers and abandon it.
One of the chapters you dedicate in the book discusses concussions, a real hot button issue right now. Just with all this information coming out, how have you taken that information, being that you've incurred a lot of this damage to your head? I mean, it's one thing for someone like me to read about it, but you experiencing this stuff firsthand, I mean, how have you taken this information?
It hits home. In case you guys don't know, I've got a little blinking problem, and I don't know for sure where it came from, but I think, you know, in years to come, we're going to find out these shots to the head took a bigger toll on us as wrestlers than any of us realized. And I had a doctor who was telling me, you know, move your eyes to the left, and I have a lot more mobility going left than I do right. Like, I actually have to turn my neck to look as far right. You know, my peripheral vision isn't as good, and I think it's because I took a lot of shots to the same part of the head. As more information comes in about concussions, as we learn that it's not just necessarily that lights out, you know, bell ringing hit, but the succession of small jarring blows, maybe even coming from a hard landing in the ring or on the concrete, not necessarily a shot directly to the head. I know this is a run-on sentence here, but it's caused some great concern for me, because I thought, okay, I've only had 6 or 7 honest-to-goodness concussions, when in truth I've had dozens and dozens of smaller blows to the brain, to where it takes me a while to get back to feeling normal, if there's such a thing as normal, following a match. I was groggy for days after the Ric Flair match, although the only time I was hit in the head was with my own book. But I think possibly just the jolt of landing hard on the concrete just rattles my brain around in a way that I can't have done anymore. So when I talk about having just a couple matches left, you know, I mean, I've got just a couple matches left.
What did that Ric Flair match kind of tell you coming out of that match? Was it the kind of match you put a lot of pressure on yourself to kind of, this is going to define where I fit into the TNA roster and on the card?
No, actually, I mean, I was almost feeling like I had set myself up for disappointment following the in-ring promo that was so intense. The only drawback to that promo was that we had a month before the next week of TV aired. And where if I had said, boom, Thursday night, Ric Flair, next Thursday, and had 7 days to prepare for it, I think emotionally that would be a lot easier than having a few weeks for it to wear off and then trying to regain that momentum. And I think the fact that it was as good as it was, and I'll go out there and say I thought it was really good, maybe even great, is due in large part to Ric Flair bring out the best in me, because I think there is a pressure I felt to kind of, you know, do something special when I was in there with Ric. And before we went out there, about 10 minutes before, I just walked over. I said, Ric, I may have other matches, but I don't think I'll have a chance to have a match this important ever again.
And, you know, there's been a lot said about my relationship with Rick, but I think there is a deep, definite mutual respect there that makes that type of match and that type of promo possible.
As we wrap up here, another chapter in the book you did dedicate to kind of addressing the whole Chris Benoit situation. Yeah. Was that a chapter that it almost was, from your part, a bit of closure and understanding on your own part to write this? So many wrestlers, it's just, there is no way to really explain this, and maybe writing is the best way to kind of draw your own.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the written word is so, you know, powerful in finding closure for all kinds of situations. And this Benoit thing, you know, it really ate me up for a long time, to where I was, you know, very self-conscious about even being a wrestler in the wake of all this negativity. And I realized that I would have a chance to address it when a lot of the hype wore off, when, you know, people were willing to listen to more than just the Roy Rage soundbite. Yeah. And I thought I'd, you know, have a voice to lend to that conversation. I was essentially trying, by calling it an open letter, it's my attempt to reach anybody who's interested in being a wrestler, anybody who currently is or has been. And I even said in my last TNA Wrestling.com blog that I think every wrestler should read it. And it's not me trying to get a plug in to buy the book. I'm saying photocopy it, borrow it, do it, whatever you do. And I'm not trying to create the impression that it's the definitive answer to anything, but it's part of a conversation that we need to have. And I think I made a valuable contribution to that. If I can just say that the biggest compliment I think I'll ever receive about this book is that right before our show started at Bound for Glory, Alex Shelley came over and he said, I just want to thank you for taking the time to address, you know, situations that younger wrestlers are encountering. We talked for a couple minutes and I said, Alex, don't you have a match? And he goes, yeah. And his music started playing. And he went out there and then tore the house down with Generation Me. And I thought, like, for a guy like that, who's so good, to go out of his way to thank me and to feel like an older guy like me had really made a difference right before, you know, the biggest match of the year for him was an outstanding compliment.
All proceeds for this book are going to two organizations, Child Fund International, as well as RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network. Tell us a bit about, just quickly, about how you came into contact with both of those.
And I will say, and I've said this before today in Canada, so it's not completely new. I always said, a few weeks ago, I would have corrected you and said, no, the 100% of the advance, not necessarily the proceeds, but now that I've seen the sales figures, it's 100% of the proceeds.
And I didn't read that on Wikipedia. Did some research.
We're not going to outsell the advance. I felt, and I asked the question in the afterward, whether this book was important enough to write. And I think by having, at that time in my mind, a 50% a total of the advance going to charity, made it feel like it was important. And once I made the mental commitment and then the verbal commitment to donating all of it, I felt like I would be out there on the book trail speaking about something that was larger than just the book. And so I've talked in the past about, you know, sponsoring kids and how much it's meant to me. The amount that goes to Child Fund is set to help victims of rape and abuse in Sierra Leone incurred during their civil war and their children. And the amount to RAIN is Rape, like you said, Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network. It's a group that I've actually started volunteering for about 10 months ago. It's become a very important part of my life. And if nothing else, I will consider this book tour to be a success, just because I've been able to get some really good positive feedback from people who think it's really helpful to have a guy, and an unlikely guy, talking about what's largely seen as a female issue.
And my final question is that, as you kind of take a retrospective look at your career, Mick, you were largely brought up on a national scene as a guy that could take a lot of punishment, and when we saw you in WCW, ECW, WWE, a tremendous verbal ability, and that today's environment, it's so much different in that in today's WWE environment, for example, there's no way you're getting thrown off a cell, nor are you and The Rock going out there for 20 minutes.
Right.
Do you wonder that had you been coming up in this era, would it have been a much different career for you, knowing that this...
You know, it may have been, but I think it's the same argument that fans of modern-day basketball have. It's, George Mikan would have never existed, a guy like Nowinski who can shoot the 25-footer, or, this type of baseball player wouldn't be able to compete because, they only threw three pitches in the 50s. I think you have to always assume that really good performers or really good athletes would have found a way to excel in any time period. I may not have gotten the lucky breaks that I did. I may not have had, the people standing up for me and going out of their way to vouch for me, like a Jim Ross, or even to the younger guys when I was breaking in, like Terry Taylor and Iceman Parsons and Gentleman Chris Adams. And I may not have ever gotten a guy like Vince McMahon to take a really close look and give the ball to an unlikely ball carrier. But I think I would have found a way to do something.
And that is going to wrap things up for another edition of Review Away. But first up, we've got your feedback, which I was not going to forget. And, Wei, why don't you start us off?
We go to this man who says, I am a first-time poster and first-time listener. I'm a massive Mick fan. I really first got into WWF around the time he turned from Mankind into Cactus Jack before Royal Rumble 2000, and he's been my favorite since. I got the set about a month ago and really enjoyed it. Documentary is great, nothing particularly revelatory, but for a guy with countless memoirs, it's kind of hard to unearth anything you haven't read already. Having said that, I could listen to Mick talk for hours on end, so it's not really a negative. The 2 and a bit hours fly by. The only negative is too much Miz. What is going on with his eyebrow? Looks gross, whatever it is. No TNA talk, obviously, but who cares? Favorite parts? Hunter talking about the WrestleMania 2000 match. Mick's training with Dominic DiNucci and Shane Douglas. Mick's daughter talking about her dad being a hero. Some of these might be on the extras rather than the main feature, actually. If you're buying this for the matches, get his Greatest Hits and Misses set instead. That has all his big matches. This is mainly obscure matches, which is cool too, but not what I would start with.
We go to Vince from Vaughn. To be honest, the sock was the primary reason I picked up the Blu-ray. I probably should have bought two. For those, the Blu-ray comes with a commemorative sock around it.
No. Nice.
Seriously, what am I going to do with one sock? Oh, well, too late now. As for the documentary, it was good, not great, just good. The clip of the ear falling off was great. Okay, not neat to look at. Who wants to watch a guy lose an ear? The fact that the video of the incident exists and was found is neat, but I don't need to see it. The mentioning of Kevin James was unexpected and a bit pointless. If Kevin James was interviewed for the documentary, the mentioning would have made more sense. I really enjoyed the clips of a silly Mankind interaction acting with the more serious characters like Mr. McMahon and The Rock. It makes for a heartwarming aspect to Mick's life. Here's a guy who first made a living by hurting himself, now finding other avenues of entertainment to keep him both employed and relevant to audiences. All things considered, this is an in-depth piece, lots of detail from Mick himself. It filled in a bunch of the gaps in the history of the characters that I had missed. In conclusion, the Blu-ray set gets 2 thumbs up. Not only did I get enjoyment from it, but so did my mother. If we both agree it's good, then it must be.
Danny Hernandez, what a great documentary. The last Mick Foley DVD I watched was Hard Knocks and Cheap Pops, which was more of a kayfabe documentary on Mick. So there was a documentary, but I guess a more kayfabe one. Some highlights would have been the section that focused on Vader. I could watch a gif of Foley smacking Vader with a shovel all day. Another was the section where Vince told Mick that dude love made people feel good. I feel when WWE does documentaries on guys that have a lengthy journey to the E are far more entertaining. For example, some of my favorites are the Stone Cold, Jericho, and CM Punk documentaries because of the struggle they all went on before becoming big. And documentaries like Rock and Cena where they didn't go on the long struggle aren't as good. Overall, a must-watch for the documentary, and very interested to watch the matches on the DVD where JR and Joey Styles provide alternative commentary.
Oh, that's cool. Paul Ellett writes, I've never been a huge fan of Foley, so I didn't have astronomically high expectations for this. Maybe that's why I enjoyed it so much. That said, the first WWF pay-per-view I watched properly was the 2000 Rumble, in which Foley was involved in one of my favorite matches of all time. As is the case with so many WWE releases, this boasted an excellent use of archival footage and other territories and companies, especially of Foley training originally with DiNucci. That was really cool that they had training footage of him with DiNucci, if we didn't note that.
I didn't note that.
You did?
Thanks for listening.
I wasn't listening. Sorry.
All right.
It really added to a story which was a testament to traveling the world to learn your craft, even if that craft included throwing yourself into barricades very, very hard. Seeing Shane Douglas as a talking head was pretty funny, considering the last time he was seen on WWE programming, he was being escorted out of the arena. That's right. Vader has always been a joy to listen to when interviewed out of character, and a terrific contrast to the wild nature of his gimmick. Foley's self-deprecation in a business of huge egos was somewhat poignant, especially when he spoke of lackluster performances and regrettable returns from retirement. While not in the higher echelon of biographies, a very enjoyable watch nonetheless.
Right, I forget about him.
Yeah, that was a year ago where he showed up before the Extreme Rising show at Raw and was promptly told.
So I guess it is quite the surprise that he's on this.
Yeah.
We go to Tanis, who says, this was an excellent DVD. I heard most of the same things from Beyond the Mat and his Hits and Misses DVD, but I did like hearing a different in-depth perspectives on Foley's life and career from people such as his high school friends, Vader, Shane Douglas, and countless others. Them talking about the 99 Rumble match reminded me of how his kids and wife were crying when Rock was hitting him with the chair shot after chair shot and Beyond the Mat. I know he said he should have not come back so many times, but he made Randy Orton legit. I know his body is in pain and on a daily basis, but the overall impression I got from the DVD is that he lived out his dream. I'd recommend this for every wrestling fan to watch.
Next up, we go to Blaine. Best DVD of the year so far. I'm surprised we haven't really seen a documentary on Foley until now. Having said that, I thought it was the best doc since the rise and fall of ECW. Outside of the hardcore stuff, Foley's matches have never been the greatest, but the selections for this one were pretty good. I'm a little surprised that they didn't include some of his more recent matches, like the ones against Orton, Edge, or Flair, which I thought were all really good, and I'm equally surprised that there weren't any promos thrown on this DVD, but despite those minor criticisms, this is the best one they've done in a while.
From Mark Cardoso, the WWE released other past Foley DVDs with documentaries as well, but I liked how they brought in Kevin Sullivan, Shane Douglas, and Vader to comment on this one. I remembered most of Foley's first run in WCW where he attacked his tag partners after they lost a tag match to whatever face tag team they were facing. The one thing I was surprised they didn't mention on the documentary is that Tony Schiavone, that will put the butts in the stands comments when Foley won the WWF title. But then again, it could have been a good thing since previous Foley and Monday Night Wars DVDs drilled that fact to the ground.
We go to Mike Still. I've been really excited for this DVD since I heard it was coming out. I've always been a big Foley fan and, as a result, have read all of his books and come across numerous interviews with him and seen a lot of him on 24/7's Roundtable. One thing that sets Mick apart is that he's a natural storyteller to the point that he will perfect and retell a story in the same words over and over, a trend I was worried this documentary would continue. The feature surpasses all expectations, though, with a combination of Mick's own words, mostly brand new stories or perspectives not in his books, and great interviews from his colleagues. You get a much more full perspective of an unlikely career. I just watched the CM Punk DVD last week and found a lot of parallels. Both Punk and Foley are the underdogs, the unique personalities that are so off the mark from what Vince McMahon is looking for that they only succeed because of an incomparable combination of being smarter, more creative, charismatic, and dedicated than any of their peers. The cream always rises. It's a shame that even to this day, the same people who released these DVDs can't seem to recognize how to foster talents like Kevin Steen, Colt Cabana, and plenty of others who work the same way. Great set, something I'd recommend for Cactus fans and especially those not familiar with Mrs. Foley's baby boy. 9 Superfly splashes off of the roof out of 10.
Did you get a chance to watch any of the extras?
No, I didn't.
No, me neither. So, it sounds like that that is quite the incentive. We go to Gaurav from India. I became a WWE fan because of Mankind. As a kid growing up, I found the sock puppet really entertaining. This DVD is once again one of the finest ones the WWE has produced in a recent while. I would rank it right up there with Punk's DVD. The best part of this DVD is the documentary portion of it. Foley talking about being an underdog and nobody taking him seriously to becoming a main event superstar is a story which many can relate to. Did you guys notice that the part where The Rock talks about Foley was taken from Rock's DVD from last year? So, doesn't The Rock have enough time to shoot an interview about Foley for Foley's DVD? That baffled me. I wish they interviewed more Attitude Era stars like Al Snow, who had feuds with Foley. What do you guys think about... kind of hard to get any TNA guys, I imagine.
Yeah, that wasn't going to happen.
What do you guys think about the documentaries which have current superstars like Miz, Punk, Cena, etc. talking about the Attitude Era superstars? It doesn't make sense to me since they were not part of the roster during the Attitude Era.
I think, number one, it's a logistical thing, too, that you want some other voices, and these are the guys you have the easiest access to. Like, these interviews, for the most part, are shot on TV days, yeah. Just in the back with other guys. And it's great when you can get people that are outside and offer a different perspective,
yeah.
But I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that you have people on the roster if they make sense.
Like,
if anything, it puts your legends over even more.
Sure.
Because these are the stars now that were only fans of these guys. Like, these are your stars that looked – like, the stars that your stars today looked up to.
Yep.
So I don't think that's a bad thing.
Next one here. I watched this DVD a few weeks ago with my newly married wife, and we both thought it was great, but I don't think she was expecting the 2.5-hour runtime. I liked seeing lots of what was for me, previously unseen footage, but I was disappointed that they did not show the chair shots from the I Quit match with The Rock. Foley always comes across as such a genuine and humble person, and that is what makes him very listenable. I enjoyed hearing his story tell about how he grew up and how he got into the business. The dude loves stuff annoyed me, as I still to this day think it was a stupid character for someone like Foley to use. It sounded like Vince decided to do it one night when he was drunk, as I can see no other reason why he would choose to go from Mankind to Dude Love. Foley changing from Mankind to Cactus Jack during his feud with Triple H is possibly my favorite mark out moment as a fan growing up. I wish they had showed this moment, but I've watched it so many times I can live without seeing it again. And he gives this DVD 8 out of 10.
There's no doubt that Dude Love on his own would be really stupid. But Dude Love as a contrast to Mankind, I mean, I think...
As we kind of mentioned, it was kind of telling the story that this was this guy he had always aspired to be, and you kind of got that payoff on TV of him getting that brief run
yeah.
as this character he'd envisioned himself being.
But just thinking about the humor, or I don't know, just the contrast involved of, like, you have the ultra, ultra dark character and then the super stupid, stupidly light one. I thought that really worked. Finally, from Peter, who says, I really enjoyed the DVD. Foley's career is a great story, and he's a great storyteller, so I expected it to be good. A lot of grounds have already been covered in his books, but it was nice to see the physical development of his style and hear him reflect on his career choices. It's not as strong a story as, for instance, CM Punk's documentary from last year, which I still think is the WWE's best work, but you could tell they were really trying to do Foley justice. The most touching part I felt was his kids talking about how proud they were of him, and when you've seen Beyond the Mat, it's nice to know he didn't scar them for life.
All right, and that wraps up the feedback from everyone, so thank you very much for those that I posted here. We also put a poll here on the feedback, and it was Mick Foley's greatest rival, and we'll go from least to the top way.
Oh, nice.
And nobody felt it was Steve Austin or Randy Orton. From there, 4.1% voting Sting, 8.3% voting Big Van Vader, 16.6% for The Rock, 29.1% for Triple H, and the winner, 41.6% feeling it was The Undertaker. Hard to disagree with.
Yeah.
So there you go. Thanks to everyone who voted and left your feedback. We are going to wrap things up here. But next week, we're going to have a unique edition of Review Away, where we are not reviewing a specific event, documentary. It's going to be kind of a career retrospective way. So why don't you let the listeners in on what we have concocted?
Well, the big story of the week, of course, is the retirement of one Kenta Kobashi. And, you know, as a fan of his, you know, growing up as a wrestling fan, I thought it would be really nice to go back and watch some of his classic matches. 4 of them, to be exact.
Yes, we are going to go back and review 4 of his matches, as Wei mentioned, starting off with a match from October of 1990, where it is Kobashi, Toshiaki Kawada, and Mitsuharu Misawa taking on Jumbo Tsuruta, Akira Taue, and Masanobu Fuchi from October 19th of 1990. Then we're going to review another 5-star match from January of 97 between Kobashi and easily his most famous rival, I feel, in Misawa. The Tokyo Dome match he did in Noah with Jun Akiyama from July of 2004.
Called by Dan Lebranski and
Mauro Ranallo. And then we're going to cap it off by also reviewing his retirement match, which just happened this past weekend, which was an 8-man tag where he teamed with Akiyama, Kensuke Sasaki, and Keiji Muto.
Yeah.
So that's going to be our review next week. I think we'll post all 4 matches with the feedback thread this week, so you guys will have lots of ample opportunity to go back, watch these matches. They're very easily accessible, and I think we're going to try and get the Moro and Mouth match with the commentary posted as well, perhaps this week.
I helped produce the commentary for those, so I'm going to don't tell anybody, everybody. But
no, it's fine.
I'm going to get that up there.
Okay. The Japanese version is up online as well, but you can either listen with the Japanese commentary or with Moro and Mouth calling it as well. If you
I urge you guys
all
to really check that out, because actually Dave Meltzer was very very complimentary of the.
He said it was the best called match of 2004. I don't know how that would work because they called the match in 2006.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
Well, whatever.
But
it was very highly regarded.
Check it out. We'll have that up there.
But so there you go. So we're going to we'll review four matches of Kenta Kobashi's next week. And I think we're going to try and get W.H. Park on the show as well from Japanese Audio Wrestling to help put into context Kenta Kobashi for people that maybe have just heard the name but not seen too much of him. So it's going to be kind of a career look. It'll be our documentary, our audio documentary of Kenta Kobashi.
Okay.
Kind of. It's what it is.
Yeah, I guess so. But of course, if you guys can't wait till then and want some a great job at a career retrospective on Kobashi right now, you can go and download the latest Japanese Audio Wrestling.
Yeah.
Chris Charlton and WH talk about basically the career of this guy in way better detail than we'll be able to. So please don't compare us. Listen to that one first, and then listen to us for two foreigners' perspectives.
There you go. So that's coming up next week on Review Away. In the meantime, we will be back later this week. Thursday, new edition of the MMA Report featuring Vitor Belfort, who's going to be fighting Luke Rockhold this coming weekend in Brazil. He will be joining me on the show. Friday, back with Review and Impact. And then The Law is this Sunday night featuring the Extreme Rules pay-per-view, which we will be running down myself and Dan Lavransky as Jason Agnew is going to be away this coming Sunday. So that stuff is all coming up. You can follow Way on Twitter at Way0937, at Law Radio, and go check out liveaudiowrestling.com for all your news, podcasts, and everything else that is going on worldwide in the world of The Law. And what can we finish off today with, Mr. Ting? Is there something that really exemplifies the career of Mick Foley to you? Maybe maybe we could go a little WCW and hear Mr. Bang Bang.
Yeah,
there you go.
That'd be great.
All right, so we're going to turn the clock back here to hear Mick Foley. Mr. Bang Bang takes us out on this edition of Review Away.
He throws caution to the wind. He doesn't care about himself. He'd really be a fool to think he cares about someone else. He's not really much of keeping the action in the ring. Cause broken bones on a concrete floor are really more his thing. He's not on a team or a member of a gang. He's Cactus Jack, or better known as Mr. Bang Bang. He's as strange as a man can be. He ain't got no family. A long career is not expected.
bring Gordon to come with me next time.
Do it. He'd be great at improv, I think.
That would be amazing.
What are you talking about? Am I on speaker?
Are you recording a podcast or something, man?
So when I asked what you want to review next week, of course, I got 10 million answers. Yeah. And they were all like individual ones. So I don't know. Is there anything you feel like watching next week? Or what's your week like?
It's fine. Yeah, I can do anything. Like, don't feel like you got to limit the options, according to me.
I always feel I need to. I feel it's like I'm the teacher giving you homework, and it's like such a nice weekend out, and I'm going to make you stay inside and do math homework.
No, don't feel that way at all.
The only one that got two votes was like this Boy Meets World episode that, I don't know, what the fuck were you going to review a 20-minute episode of Boy Meets World on?
Exactly. Well,
let me skim through these as we're doing the review, and or if you find something, I could care less.
What's in the news?
Well, I mean, there's the usual May pay-per-views.
Oh yeah, didn't we say we wanted to do a Kobashi thing?
Yeah, but you said you didn't want to, though, which is fine.
I do. How about the card? Like, is that whole card, the retirement card, up?
It's just the main event. That's
just the main event. Yeah. That's up. I'd like to do a Kobashi match. Like, from history.
Could you find that card?
That whole card? Or the one you're talking about from Noah?
Yeah, I'm just thinking with, like, English commentary might make it easier for people.
It's not the card. It's only really two matches.
Oh, I see.
And one of them's cut off because they're hour
long. Oh, right. Yeah, because, the Tokyo Dome would be really long.
Let's do a classic Kobashi match.
We can. It's just... Can we do a whole show on one match?
Right, no, it would be hard. You know what? I mean, why don't we do a couple Kobashi matches then?
Let's see if we can find out.
Like, see what's online. Because, trying to think of a... Like, because the five-star matches are what? Let's see.
We can review the link I put up last week. 9 hours of Kobashi's GHC title defenses.
That's a good resource. But, I mean, we're not going to do all of those, of course, but... Okay, so Kobashi was involved in how many of the Meltzer's five-star
23 matches he's had.
23 five-star matches?
Yeah. I was researching that.
No fucking way.
Yeah, it's crazy.
How? Because right now, I mean, in all Japan, I only see 98 versus Misawa, 99 versus Misawa, and then 99 again with Jun Akiyama versus Misawa.
Go to are you on Wikipedia?
Yeah.
Go below, because...
I mean, there's...
That's where I read it.
Noah... He's got two.
Look at these. All these, dude. Are you looking at all these?
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Hold me. How did I miss those? Oh, yeah. Okay. Holy fuck. Wow. Yeah, well, that is quite daunting. I mean, of those...
I wish there was, like, some documentary on Kobashi. That'd be awesome to...
Yeah. Japanese documentary. I'm sure there is.
We've already reviewed him and Joe, right? We did that. Misawa match where he won the title. That was a pretty historic show.
Well, why don't we pick like one match from like each era? You know what I mean? Like, why don't we pick his first five-star match?
Let's pick, from like here. Do you want to pick all from this list?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
We can do this first one, which is like, these are all, I think, pretty easy to find online. Every time I search a five-star match, it's always online.
Yeah, it would be even cool to review a... See, there's a match here from 1985.
Okay.
Oh, wait a second. Is this him?
Yeah, I would love them to span... Let's pick, like, three or four matches, and they span his entire career. And we can include his retirement match in there, too, if you want.
Kuniaki Kobayashi. That's not him, is it? Like, what... See, this is a match with Misawa as Tiger Mask?
Yeah.
And then I think that's Kobayashi in like with, like, long hair from the 80s. So, like, this would have been their... Like, at least one of their first matchups. Kuniaki Kobayashi.
I don't think that's Kenta Kobayashi, because there is a performer named Kuniaki Kobayashi.
Oh, yeah? Okay, never mind then. Yeah, you're right.
But we can find a match with Kobayashi when he was, like, a young boy, because he, like, lost, like, the first 500 matches of his career or something.
Yeah, they all look the same to me.
Kobayashi. We should do a Misawa match, a Kawada match.
Yeah. And then, let's pick one from, like, let's pick the earliest five-star match. Some
this one? Do you want to do this with Kawada and Misawa?
Yeah, if we could find.
Let me search it. I'm sure.
That's from 91.
It's against Saruta Taue and Fuchi.
October 1999. This is from 91.
April 20th.
I mean, it doesn't matter.
Dave Meltzer's five-star wrestling collection.
Oh, yeah, click on that.
Yeah, this is the match. October 19th. Great. Okay, so we can pick that one.
Yeah, copy the links.
Or, yeah, I'll do that.
We can post them up.
Then let's pick like a singles match with like
from like late 90 or like
yeah from the All Japan
yeah,
like period with
that, yeah exactly
because that lets us I mean there's this Kawada one there's what's the one where he broke his arm it was either him or Misawa broke his arm during the match I think it was this
yeah Kawada broke his arm
oh okay do you know which match it was.
That might have been Misawa versus Kawada.
Oh, yeah, that's probably it. Never mind. Well, I don't know. Pick whatever you want here.
Let me type in like. Let's pick the best one because I don't.
We should pick a Misawa match.
Yeah,
that's his most famous opponent. So we got
Obashi Misawa best match. And then what's the last 5-star match you had?
The last one was with Joe, and prior to that, it was
Tokyo Dome? Okay, we'll do that one. Do that one. We'll do the Dan and Moro's version.
Okay.
I think I'll even upload it.
Okay, yeah, that'd be great. Okay, so we'll do that. I actually just watched that match last week, but I'd like to watch it with Moro's comments.
Yeah.
Tokyo Dome.
Okay, let's see.
There's a one him in Misawa where he wins the GHC title for the... to start his title reign. But that one's a little later. It's not All Japan.
Favorite Misawa Kobashi match. Let's see what people say.
There's a 98 one, a 99 one, and then that no
one. You know what? We should do the retirement match, too. Shouldn't we?
Yeah.
Is that too much?
I think 4 matches is good. Because these are all probably like 30 to 40 minutes each.
Okay. Let's do from January 1997.
January 97.
January 21st, 1997. Seems to be the consensus as the best one. Yeah, I got it. Oh, there's a music video. Alright, here we go. Yeah, it's on Vimeo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's on Daily Motion as well. 42 minutes.
Holy shit. Is this going to be doable?
Oh my god. How long is the retirement match?
The retirement match is 40.
And... they're all going to be at least 40. That Tokyo Dome one is at least like 40 minutes. So how about
I can get by. I just watched this retirement match last night, so I'm just going to skim through it and get the big notes. I'm not going to rewatch it.
Oh, fuck. All right. That 6-man tag, how long is that one?
That one is...
it's actually going to end up being longer than anything.
It's 30 with everything. So
40, 30, 100, 150 minutes. It's like 2.5 hours. It's essentially a pay-per-view.
Yeah. It's like 150 minutes, almost 3 hours of fucking Kobashi.
Well, let's think about the review, too. Like, can we... You think we can make it work? Just to talk
about I mean, I'll get a lot of notes and stuff on his career, and we can we should have like WH or someone.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Let's get WH.
WH. All right.
We're just gonna have to figure out timing wise WH because it's difficult with him in Japan.
Right.
No, this will be fun. I'd like to go back.
Yeah, I like this too. We should do more like
I know.
Not necessarily card centric, but like topic centric. We recorded all this.
Save it. We might need it.
All right.
So thanks for everyone on Twitter. We're not listening to any of you.
Oh, fuck.
Oh, man.
All right. All set?
Yeah.